You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
So if we can just get Cuba back, they're not going to get rid of Kennedy. They're going to be fighting over Cuba. They're going to be dividing Cuba among themselves. So this is how I was persuaded that it was a good idea to kill Castro.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show, The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. Judith Ferry Baker is an author, teacher, and an artist. She is the author of two nonfiction personal memoirs, Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, and David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, Participant in Anti-Castro Bioweapon Plot, Friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, and key to the JFK assassination. She was once a promising young science prodigy who hoped one day to find a cure for cancer. She offers extensive documentation on how she came to be a cancer expert at such a young age, the personalities who urged her to relocate to New Orleans, and what led to her involvement in the development of a biological weapon that Oswald was to smuggle into Cuba to eliminate Fidel Castro. Early on in the summer of 1963, during her work in New Orleans, she learned of plans to kill the president. Judith Ferry Baker, welcome.
Hello, Bonnie. Nice to hear you.
It's such a pleasure to finally meet you. I only wish it was in person. Judith, I think we should start with a brief history of how you were brought to New Orleans in April of 1963 to develop a fast-acting cancer bioweapon to be used to assassinate Fidel Castro. I did a two-part program with Ed Haslam, author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, in which he talked quite a bit about you on the show, but there are bound to be many listeners who did not catch those programs. You were a young high school science prodigy, weren't you?
Well, and yes, but a lot of people think like I went straight to New Orleans from high school. Actually, I had 2 years of training in advanced methods, you know, working in oncological methods. You're talking about tissue culture. I actually developed a test to determine whether someone had cancer just using a blood test. And by the way, it took 46 years before they created a similar blood test. So when I was removed or kicked out of cancer research because of objecting to using prisoners, you know, who were unaware that when they volunteered to, you know, work and, you know, be volunteers in cancer research, that if the materials we injected into them proved effective, they would die, you know. So I really regret the fact that I've been was banned from cancer research by the same organization that gave me so much hope and promised me, you know, early entry into Tulane University Medical School, you know, would skip 2 years of college, that I'd be working with the eminent doctors, and especially Dr. Mary Sherman, have free room and board and a stipend and all that. And it looked like everything was just so wonderful to be able to come to New Orleans. And, of course, I'd been trained at Roswell Park Institute to handle the deadly viruses that could cause cancer, such as SV40 monkey virus, with Dr. James T. Grace. In a summer program there with, under Dr. Moran, just for seminars. And I was working in particular in that entire summer for Dr. George E. Moore. He was the director of that institute, which was a very highly recognized cancer research institute. It's now called Roswell Park Institute. But then it was called Roswell Park Memorial Institute for Cancer Research. And what's important about that is that I learned how to also formulate one of the best formulas. And I say formulate because we were still working on it. The formula that we were working on that would allow us to grow cancer cells faster than ever before and more efficiently, keep them alive longer. Today it's called RPMI, that is Roswell Park Memorial Institute, RPMI 1640. And this formula came out a few years after I was there, but we were working in Dr. Moore's own private lab creating this. So I'd spent some time actually helping to create this formula in 1961, And at the time that I reached New Orleans, I was probably one of the few people in the world that had access to that formula outside of the Institute. So I had some special skills that were valuable, plus the fact I could read 2,400 words a minute, and they needed to get a lot of the latest research updated to see where they could go next. They had reached an impasse in this project, which had begun on March 23, 1962. Dr. Ochsner, of course, had been lured into, oh, hey, we have something here that could be called a biological weapon. It was an anomaly, and they took advantage of it. Dr. Ochsner was virulently anti-Castro and anti-communist. He resented the fact that Castro had cut off Cuba from all the training of young doctors that he had conducted. They would come there and stay at Brent House, as they did from all over South America and Latin America in general. All of a sudden, he had no more access to them. And I would tell you, their parents weren't happy about that either. And some of them were doctors. I mean, their young men were being shipped off now to USSR for training, would come back, and they put them on salaries and sent them out to take care of the peasants and so on. There's one example of a doctor, a young doctor, who was very resentful and trusted, who had wanted to become a famous and rich plastic surgeon. And my joke is that now instead he's working on taking, ingrown toenails out of people, you know. So there was some resentment there. Dr. Ochsner had trusted the medical community himself. He understood what trust was because, of course, he had inoculated his own grandson. It's widely said that his grandson died within just a few days. Actually, his grandson came down with he was inoculated with the polio vaccine by Dr. Ochsner, his own grandson. He became ill in a couple of days. He died a week later. And this devastated Dr. Ochsner, who had trusted the Cutter vaccine in which he had stock. And he realized if he could trust doctors that much with something that could be injected into your body, so would Castro. And believe it or not, some of the doctors that Castro trusted shouldn't have been trusted. And there were also technicians. If you have a little bottle and look, it's labeled penicillin, but it really contains virulent active cancer cells that could kill you, how would you know? So what if a technician turns up the x-ray machine really high when Castro was standing in front of it on his checkup, which was coming up? How would you know it? And it wouldn't have been turned up. So he got a huge dose. And then what if certain cancer cells were placed in a blood sample and they're looking at the microscope and they see live cancer cells in this blood sample? They're going to put him in front of an x-ray machine to see if there are any tumors. And when he gets a full body scan like that, he's going to be, he's going to be inundated with a lot more x-rays. You can imagine what the plan was. And there were people in line to do it. Why such an elaborate scheme? Because everything they tried, I mean, look, Castro's still alive. The CIA had tried everything. So this was a long-term project, and somewhere during the project it was learned, we learned, it was a little too late, but we learned that the decision had been made to kill Kennedy, and it seemed to Dr. Sherman and David Ferry and others. David Ferry, by the way, pretended to be anti-Kennedy. He changed his mind after he, that's a long story, I'll talk about it some other time, but basically David Ferry was someone who knew Lee Oswald for a long time. My book, David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, explains who he is, and of course he's in the film JFK. You can see his representation by Joe Pesci, however you pronounce his name. Anyway, David Ferry actually was very anti-Castro, anti-communist, and he was for some period of time anti-Kennedy because he blamed Kennedy for what happened at the Bay of Pigs. He had trained so many of these young people, and some of them actually died. One of them suffocated to death, Dave told me, in a container that was left out in the sun of like over 100 people in it, or 90 people, something like that, and they were prisoners, and they were being hauled, into a camp somewhere. And a number of them suffocated to death and died of heat stroke and so on when they opened up the container. I mean, they baked them in there, and David didn't forget that, and he was certain that Kennedy, he really stood up there in front of 70 officers, retired military officers. He was a gifted speaker and rhetorician, and he said Kennedy should be shot. Well, they made him get off the stage, but they said, look, Dave, come here. We want to talk to you. We feel the same way about Kennedy. Would you like to learn a little more? Do you really feel like that? And, of course, he did at the time. Later, David Ferry learned that it wasn't Kennedy who was to blame for all of that. It was his treacherous generals, treacherous CIA. And now when he understood, he was deep into where talks were going on, and some of them, a few of them, were serious. And that's the background here. When I came to New Orleans, David Ferry secretly now realizes that President Kennedy is in deep trouble. He has learned about some groups that want to kill him. He believes and tells Dr. Mary Sherman, if we can't kill Castro and divert these ideas from developing into something more dangerous, it was already known that Kennedy would be coming to Texas. You had Albert Thomas was supposedly quite ill. He's in Houston, and he had been a congressman or had just retired, or maybe still was, but he'd soon leave the position. And Albert Thomas, they were going to hold a dinner for him, a kind of a, you know, thank you. Thank you, Albert, for being our wonderful congressman. And he's going to retire or something like that. Kennedy, that's how he was invited to Texas. And it turned into something else. But we have a famous photo showing Lyndon Johnson soon after he's sworn in, right there on Air Force One, turning his head. Lady Bird is smiling in her kind of a grim smile. Jackie Kennedy is looking like she has just been dragged through the plumes of the fires of hell, standing there at his side. And he's looking over at Albert Thomas, who's giving a wink. He's winking at Lyndon Johnson. Now, that was what we were trying to avoid. I was led to believe I got on the secret side of things accidentally. Originally, I was supposed to work with Dr. Sherman in her regular bone lab, and they would be giving me materials, and I would be working on them there. But as it turned out, David Ferry had been selected to break the ring. There was a ring of labs that was involved, at least three or four labs. And the problem was is they could communicate with each other if the ring was completed. David was chosen because Mary Sherman had been training him. David had been in cancer research as an amateur, but he was a brilliant man. Great pilot, knew five languages fluently that he spoke, French, German, Italian, Spanish, and English. And besides that, he knew ancient Greek, modern Greek, and Latin, and so on. This man, again, a gifted speaker and able to speak in many languages, and was actually a pilot at that time going between New Orleans and cities such as Dallas and Houston on a regular route with Eastern Airlines. Now, by the time I met him, he had been fired by Eastern Airlines for an incident with a 15-year-old boy. Now, all of this comes together because David is now, he was basically rescued by Carlos Marcello, the godfather of New Orleans, got him a job with G. Ray Gill, and also he was working for Guy Bannister. We see that he was actually analyzing autopsies for Bannister, and in the book David Ferry, again, you're going to find out a lot more about that and how he learned to analyze autopsies. But all of this comes together that David has some medical information and understanding, and he understands especially how to handle cancer, and that's not for everybody. Not everybody can do that. And he was chosen by Dr. Sherman, and she gave him some training so that he would be able to handle this virus, this very powerful cancer that had been developed using a linear particle accelerator to create mutations. And some of the mutations, most of them, of course, are no good. When we're talking about using 500 mice at a time, 50 mice at a time, and eventually it was 500 mice at a time. Then we went to monkeys, you see, finally to test humans.
I'm speaking with author and former cancer researcher Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show, The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
All of this, I'm told that we can avoid World War III, and maybe 20 million Americans won't die if we can make sure that Castro is out of the picture, will never again aim nuclear weapons at me and my family and everybody in you in Florida and at the United States of America and all the people there. This is what I was told. And when I came to New Orleans, I thought, again, I was going to be on the open side of everything. I didn't know what the nature of the project was, but through a series of circumstances, which involved Lee and his meeting me, because when I came to New Orleans, I came 2 weeks early, and there was nobody there. Nobody. Like, I'm talking about my doctors were in South America. Now, we have a newspaper article about it. I don't know where exactly Mary Sherman was, but she was out of town as well. And here, I was at loose ends. I'd expected steak and you know, and wine. I didn't drink wine, but you get the picture, I think. I thought I was going to be met by famous doctors. They were going to love me and take good care of me. They promised to do so, and I was going to work my tail off for them. I wanted to cure cancer. That was my goal. My grandma had died of it, and all the newspaper articles, I had newspaper reporters following me around because of all the I had given mice lung cancer in only 7 days in my own primitive circumstances in Manatee High School, working in a lab that was moved under the stadium, because when those tumors started developing, we had some frightened high school science teachers and others, you know. So we had two Nobel Prize winners. We had three doctors, the best there were, Dr. George Morgan, director at Roswell Park. We had Dr. Harold Diehl, D-I-E-H-L, the vice president of the American Cancer Society, and who, in fact, was the head of all the research projects for the American Cancer Society. And then with him, Dr. Alton Ochsner, who was flown in after I displayed and showed the work that I had done, and they wanted him to help inspect this. Of course, it was in the newspapers, you know, Judith meets with two Nobel Prize winners and all of this. And it says, because I had done something that had never been done before, I was now going to be sent to Roswell Park and so on. Well, that went on briefly, about 2 years of training I received. And at the same time, of course, I'm going to college. I was estranged from my parents. My fiancé was supposed to be coming. When I was eventually banned from cancer research for testing about these prisoners being used, I was sent back to Florida. It saved my life. But also there, because I had married this man, I was Mrs. Robert Allison Baker III. It really, really helped to hide who I was. As everybody that worked on the project, almost all of them were murdered. So it's just, I say everybody I know who was working on the project. So that's where it was. And here's Lee Oswald. He's being sent to kind of make sure I don't get hurt. I'm an asset that they want to use. Because he wasn't told enough, and I knew so much about, well, like anti-Castorites. I had been working, after all, in Florida. I had dated, for example, the son of the finance minister of Castro's Cuba. It was Tony Lopez Frisquet. And, oh, he was a cute guy. He really was. But he told me nightmare things about Castro. So I really hated Castro, and here I was hating Kennedy. One of the things that Lee did over time was he taught me to admire and respect and even love President Kennedy. Just as I had in high school before I'd been influenced by all my anti-Castro Cuban friends at University of Florida. What a change, what a difference it was to know somebody like Lee who had such respect and admiration for our president. So I'll take a breath here and let you might have wondered if I've taken you too far in too many directions here. Let's see what you think.
Well, no, that's very interesting, Judith. Now, whose brainchild was the fast-acting cancer bioweapon? You sort of indicated that it was Dr. Yeah. Ochsner's project.
Well, it seems that Dr. Ochsner had worked quite a while with Dr. Mary Sherman. She had gotten interested in polio herself. She was an orthopedic surgeon. She had to go over to Crippled Children's Hospital all the time and do surgery on their legs to unbend them because the tendons would get all tight and they'd be all curled up, and she'd have to move the tendons on the bones. Sometimes they had to cut up one bone here or there so that it was got twisted or whatever, and she saw all the suffering going on. She was very concerned. She and Dr. Ochsner were very concerned about the fact that this vaccine that was supposed to cure polio and all that actually was giving people polio and killing them. When they inspected it and looked into it, they found the SV40 monkey virus, a completely different thing than what they were looking for. And basically, when they inspected the virus and wondered what it did, and at first wondered if that was what was causing the problems, they began culturing it. And lo and behold, when they did tissue cultures with it, cancer began to grow very rapidly. And they, she had Sarah Stewart and Sarah Eddie. We have these oncologists and research scientists that Dr. Sherman knew in Chicago, and she was in contact with them. Basically, it looks like Dr. Sherman was able to realize that we had something that causes cancers in 100% of any primates that were injected with it. What would it do in humans? That was a concern. And when she found out, as they all did, in 1963, we had 98 million doses of this material loaded with the SV40 cancer-causing monkey virus. And the government was hiding it. They had already had too many recalls already of, you know, contaminated polio vaccines. And the word came out, well, look, we're going to cure cancer before this erupts in the human population. Let's not worry about it. Let's eradicate polio. And besides, we'll lose an awful lot of money. And besides, people will be afraid of vaccines if we recall 98 million doses of it. So they gave it to us. So, yeah, so Mary Sherman sees this. They were trying to work with this, the SV40 monkey virus. They found that it could create a rapidly developing cancer. By the time I got in the project, they had a monstrous cancer. It was nothing like I'd ever seen before, and I'd seen a lot. And this was outrageous. The cancer cells would divide and multiply so quickly, and it seemed that they overgrew themselves immediately. They just went so quickly from stage to stage, and Mary had actually stopped them at different stages and labeled the times, and I could see how fast this could grow. It was frightening, and I was intrigued. She wanted me to see it. They talked to me about how I'd accidentally been brought into the wrong site because David Ferry had looked for an assistant, had asked for an assistant because his Eastern Airline hearings, trying to get his job back with Eastern Airlines, they had him go to Miami a lot. And the other thing that was going on, which was just as important as Carlos Marcello, trusted him. He's just a genius, wanted him to help him with his upcoming trial. And here David was all locked up in trying to get this cancer thing done in his kitchen. And he had the ability. We had the ability to do it there. It's not as complicated as you might think in certain areas. You know, need lots of acetone and lots of Bunsen burner. You know, you've got to have fire, and you have to have means to clean up and keep it clean. And David Ferry's kitchen needed cleaning all the time. That at any rate, here we have David Ferry has been given this training. He's asked for an assistant. He thought I was the one because since he was a homosexual, that they wouldn't send a guy. And here I'm a girl coming in, so he accepted that. They told me a lot more than they should because the doctors were not in town. Mary Sherman then has to tell me the truth. She and Dr. Ochsner had decided, they're very anti-Castro and they're very anti-communist, that they thought it behooved them to take this material. Castro smoked cigars like a smokestack. And all this time, these three doctors, Dr. Deal, Dr. Moore, and Dr. Ochsner had gone all around and trying to discourage people from smoking. They had already, even before the Surgeon General stuff came out, I think in 65, we have these three doctors testifying in court that smoking cigarettes or cigars will give you cancer. Dr. Oxnard put out a book about it, and now the stage was ready. Castro needed to be eliminated for everybody's good. You see that Oxnard puts in the newspaper, he says, doctors need to join the Cold War and fight in the Cold War with every means they have. And he is doing so himself. So here we've got, he's got the idea. Let's keep it spread around that smoking causes cancer. Let it keep going. And here's Judy Vary, who has created lung cancer in mice faster than it had ever been done in any of the laboratories at that time. And I've got this training, and they bring me to New Orleans. And I bring with me the formula that can grow these cancers even faster. So there you are. That's what happened to me. Then Lee Oswald, because I was at loose ends, and I had very little money when I came here, and the Oxnard was out of town. The clinic didn't know a thing about this because the papers hadn't been signed yet. And so I was thrust into a room. Well, it's the only room I could afford at the YWCA. I thought it was going to be moving into a nice private room like had been done with me before at the Y. Instead, I'm in with four girls, you know, two strippers, a Playboy bunny, and a waitress who was so tough, I had to give her 25 cents a day so she wouldn't steal my clothes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that was the situation. And in just a week, I was there from about the 19th, arrived, 20th, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 24th, 25th. I mean, something's got to be done. I've already now been in all the strippers, you know, I've been in the show, I've been in all these different clubs, nightclubs downtown. The girls say, look, you're 19 years old. You mean you've never seen a pasty? You know, and things like that. And how about being a Playboy bunny? Well, I ended up taking a job that was only 2 hours a day at Royal Castle, enough to pay for my room until the doctors got back. It didn't take any time at all. They introduced me to David Ferry, and Lee did that. He was sent, obviously, to protect me and rescue me. I was an asset. And because of different circumstances, you can read about in the book, they thought I knew a lot more about the project and that I was the person that they had requested to be on the secret side. And since I was a girl, it seemed I really fit the bill. And by the time the doctors got back, it was too late. They had to put me in on the secret side of it. The secret side was very important because, I say, it broke that ring and it made it possible for the doctors not to be in communication with each other and figure out what was going on. So that, in a nutshell, and that's a big nut, isn't it?
I'm speaking with author and former cancer researcher Judith Vary Baker. Today's show, The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Anyway, that's the background and where it led to with the information that David Ferry had. He is telling Lee about it. Lee Oswald will get involved. Trying not only what he was doing there was making sure that Castro knew there were efforts going to be made to try to kill him. Castro knew that in New Orleans, of all places, we had whole groups of anti-Castro insurgents who were being trained to come in there and invade Cuba, trained, some of them by David Ferry, to go and drop bombs. And some of them were incendiary bombs, but others were like they're dropping biological weapons. I'm talking about, you know, pigs were getting sick, they had dengue fever. I mean, they were using biological means against the people of Cuba, not just Castro. They're trying to destroy the entire island's productivity and got rid of almost all the sugarcane crops after the Bay of Pigs. I mean, they just kept bombing and bombing and bombing before and after. They'd never take responsibility. These were always, you know, bush planes that came in, boom, and there's the fire. There the fire is raging. And Castro is getting not much help. Khrushchev, if he gives him too much help, the United States has a very, very bad relationship with the communist giant. And Khrushchev, you know, beating his shoe on the podium there, UN, we will bury you. That doesn't come across too well, you know. So it was a scary time. It was a time when only 6 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we thought we came so close to the brink of war. If it hadn't been for the courage of John F. Kennedy and his brother, I don't think we'd be here. So those were the times.
Now, one other question on cancer. In addition to the fast-acting cancer bioweapon project that you were a part of, were you ever aware of any real research going on there being done in New Orleans to either find a cure for cancer or to develop a cancer vaccine?
Well, not just in New Orleans, but because I said, remember I said I read 2,400 words a minute, and they used that as an asset to, for me to digest. And people said, how can you read that fast? And I've tried to explain, for example, some people who don't read very well, it's T-H-E is the, you know, they have to look at each letter. Others can read the, and some can read the horse ran down the street. Some can read a whole sentence. So I could read a page like that, and it was very useful. Now, it took a lot of strength and concentration to do that because of the technical aspect, but actually technical papers are easier to read than something that raises your emotions. So it wasn't as difficult as you might think, but they needed to get into these. And, yes, paper after paper I'm reading because they're trying to get the most up-to-date information on any of the viruses on any, that are causing cancer, any of the cancers. Definitely, we were on our way to a cure for cancer. We should have had it in the 70s, especially, as I say, using bacteriophage and other methods. We had it. We know that Pope John the 23rd died of stomach cancer, and the envoys were sent there, not in time, but they had a cancer vaccine with them. Remember that word, vaccine, a cancer serum. They were going to give him, try to save his life, but they were too late. So what was so potent that they could have developed something that they might use in a last-minute attempt to save the Pope's life? Well, we're looking at some very advanced technology and working in oncology. We have no doubt in my mind that we could have cured cancer in the 1970s. But you know what? It doesn't make money. When you have whole institutions set up, gigantic cancer research, no, they aren't cancer research. They are cancer treatment centers. And they have their palm trees and their fountains. And I, as I look at that, I think of the despairing people who've plowed all their money into trying to save their loved ones that built these giant, these gorgeous edifices. And that money's been poured into buildings, poured into technologies that are based on three primitive factors. One, to cut it out. Well, if it's a nice, firm tumor, cut it out and it's gone. But then after they cut it out, they almost always do radiation because in their primitive minds, they think that you have to do radiation after cutting something out. Well, it depends on the tumor, believe me, but they usually going conduct radiation anyway, and often on top of that, chemo. And, of course, that's cutting it, burning it, and poisoning it. But unfortunately, that it's almost always involves the entire human body or at least such specific parts of it in such a dramatic way. It's entirely primitive and all avenues that that go anywhere else that don't lead into these three primitive area ways of treating cancer are considered illegitimate and not worth following, frankly, because they don't make money. When you've already set up an enormous machine here where you know, you have, like mammograms, you have that you actually have the trucks going from city to city, you know, smashing women's breasts and giving them x-rays. And, of course, when any recently we had a doctor's protest this and say at least a third of the so-called cancers turn out to be nothing but benign tumors, and yet they've had their breasts cut off before this was understood. When we should have been able to use thermograms, well, thermograms are cheap. Thermography's cheap. You find a hot spot on your breast, and then you look at it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the primitive idea that we have to do biopsies of everything we're looking at, we really have the technology to actually enter any tumor and look at it and figure out whether it's cancerous or not. But they still use this quite primitive, in my opinion, biopsy method, which when you pull out and you break into the tumor, you know what? You can shed tumor cells all over the body by doing that. You're opening it up. If it's encapsulated and you punch into it and you withdraw a needle or whatever, and you know what you're getting, or you pull a slice out of it, you've got an open wound there in the cancer, and you know, you can fill up around it with lymphatic matter, with serum. And, of course, it can then actually leak into the rest of the body, shed that cancer all over the place. What is going on? Well, it's the same method they've always used. They haven't advanced, only in the sophistication of the chemicals, of the poisons. And the idea that you can eat something or drink something or have it pumped into your veins and it's going to kill a batch of cancer in your body. And what about the rest of your body? Well, those cells, they don't multiply as quickly. Now, I'll tell you what does multiply as quickly as cancer cells. That's the cells on the hair of your head. That's why all these poor people go bald. It's killing off the cells that actually multiply most rapidly. Well, guess what? A lot of cells in your body multiply rapidly, like on your fingernails. Mm-hmm. So what have we got there? We have an extremely primitive situation where this makes a lot of money. It's all been set up. It's a huge machine. You have to keep feeding the machine with lots of money. People are being trained to run the machine, and they're not going to get out of the machine. It's too profitable. That's why overseas, like, for example, in Sweden, five universities have gotten together. They're not run by any corporations. Five universities have come together, and they're looking at genetic ways to cure cancer. Doesn't make any money, folks, so you're not going to see it here.
Now, Judith, when you were developing the fast-acting cancer bioweapon, it wasn't, as I recall, it wasn't going fast enough, so you came up with a way to include X-rays with it that would speed up
right.
the cancer.
Yes, it's remarkable to me that doctors can be right on top of things. I'm not trying to criticize them, but if you've been working with something a long time, you've been trained a certain way. My advantage was that I hadn't been trained like that. I'd trained myself, and because of that, I had used approaches that they hadn't used. And when I was looking, I'd given mice lung cancer, not with ordinary mice. I eventually had gone to germ-free mice, which were available in Tampa through a research incorporated, and I had given funds to them, and they had connections with Notre Dame, so that's how I got access to them. My family at one time was involved with Notre Dame, and to make a long story short, we just loved, Notre Dame, and we had given land, and my ancestors had given land to Notre Dame. So I had these connections with Notre Dame. This doctor actually moved to Tampa with his germ-free mice from Notre Dame, and I was in contact with him through my family and everything. He supplied me with germ-free mice. Now, that means they had no contact whatsoever. They had no antibodies in their system. And then on top of that, I x-rayed them, I used x-rays, and that destroyed their immune system. That's how come I could do it. Well, that was a really unusual approach to it. And for some reason, reducing or demolishing the immune system is something that they'd forgotten or not thought about when they're, said reach an impasse. And said, look, all we have to do is make sure that Castro gets himself put in front of an x-ray machine for whatever reasons you want to get. And if you give him a big dose of x-ray, you know what happens? You develop a dry cough. Or if you just make it look like he's got cancer by putting a few cancer cells in one of his blood tests that he has, they're going to be terrified. They're going to go back. If you get somebody to get him in front of an x-ray machine a couple of times, he's going to feel so sick. And they're going to be giving him injections. And maybe they'll give him injections and say it's penicillin, just like they did to Jack Ruby, by the way. Mm-hmm. Jack Ruby understood what we were doing. When that poor man, when Julian West came from Chicago, that's the MK Ultra man. He goes and tells the outside world that Jack Ruby is crazy. Why? Well, we have Al Maddox, the jailer there. I talked to him for hours and got a lot of information from him. He says, that man came in and he gave Jack Ruby some drugs. He said, gave Jack some drugs. And all of a sudden, Jack is beating his head against the wall and he's sticking his hand up into trying to kill himself by putting his hand up, unscrewed the light bulb, trying to electrocute himself by putting his fingers up into the light socket. And then Julian West, he can inject him with cancer cells. And when Jack Ruby says, I've been injected with cancer cells, nobody's going to believe him because he's out of his mind. And that's what they did to Jack Ruby.
Wow. Well, now tell us about the note that you wrote to Dr. Ochsner and how that note represented a turning point in your cancer research in New Orleans.
Well, I came to New Orleans not to give people cancer, but to cure them. It says in the newspapers that Judy has been assigned to study how to make cancer more deadly. Now, isn't that something? So I, on top of everything I already had learned about how to make cancer grow more quickly and, you know, reproduce in animals, mice specifically, now I'm being trained to try and use these formulas and things I learned at Roswell Park and elsewhere to make cancer grow as quickly as it could, especially melanoma.
I'm speaking with author and former cancer researcher Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show, The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
All right, so knowing these different things, I find myself in this position where what I thought was, well, I still had standards. When I learned that, I'd been told originally there's this one prisoner and that this poor man, he had a problem. Because he had a terminal cancer. That's why I was told. So I asked Dave Ferry, well, look, I have to go out there and do this blood test on him to determine if the cancer that we injected in him took. And it has to be done within 72 hours. But, Dave, I've got a problem. What kind of cancer does he have? If he has the same kind of cancer we're getting him, I wouldn't be able to tell. And Dave says, just off the cuff, no, he's, you know, he's a killer and all that. He's going to die anyway, but he's perfectly healthy. You know, we're not going to electrocute him. We're going to kill him with cancer if we can. I was horrified and shocked. I mean, they're taking a man who's absolutely healthy, and he's a volunteer. And eventually I realized there had to be more than one. They were taking these men, these prisoners, who were volunteering for cancer research. And if it worked, what we gave them, it would kill them, and they were unaware of it. So I wrote a note to Dr. Ochsner. Now, that was forbidden. We were not to have a paper trail. If you read in Me and Lee, my book, How I Came to Know and Love and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, you'll learn how important it was not to have a paper trail. Lee Oswald comes as an observer, for example, when these prisoners are getting injected and when instructions are given to the clinicians on how to take care of the material, keep it alive. He's there because they don't want him to have to read anything. He has to hear it orally. He will transmit that information when he hands off the biological weapon to a medical contact, give him that information that he needs. Nothing written down. Here I wrote a note. Basically, it said something like this, that it's unethical to give a disease that can cause a terminal condition in a patient who does not have such a disease. It's just unethical. And I put it in an envelope and sealed it. And when I actually went myself physically to Ochsner Clinic, handed it to the nurse there. It was vacation time. This is end of August. And the regular nurse there who knew me, she wasn't there. Instead, it was an old woman, and you know, taking her place, obviously, because she was on vacation. And she said, looks at this envelope. She said, well, is this urgent? Because it said it's to Dr. Ochsner. I said, yes, it is. She opened it up and started to read it over the intercom. It's to Dr. Ochsner. Oh, my gosh. I got out of there as fast as I could. I knew I was dead meat. I did. I knew it. It was over. And, of course, it was. That man, when he called me on the phone, I went right to Dr. Mary's apartment hoping she'd be there. She wasn't.
Dr. Sherman, you mean?
I just wanted to come. Yeah, I wanted. Yeah, we called her Dr. Mary. We didn't use last names and often use code names. Like on the phone, Lee was Hector. I didn't use his real name. We did things like that. It was like playing spy, you know? I mean, I didn't realize how serious it all was, not until later. I thought some of this was just to keep things quiet so people wouldn't know what we were doing. And here we're trying to kill a head of state, and I've been drawn into this project. And now I was feeling dreadful. He calls on the phone, Ochsner calls over there. I'd gone there hoping that Mary, Dr. Mary, would be a comfort to me, another woman. And he begins cursing at me. Dear God. And finally, I have to have a meeting with him, and when he calls me in, not long after that, all right, he had to round me up. There were grown men who interned for him. They were in the operating room, and if one of them made a mistake or something like that, and he was very pissed off. I'm using bad words because of how bad this was. Ochsner had the ability to scream at them in such a way that some of them fainted, literally fainted. This is a man who broke his belt whipping one of his kids. Broke his belt on him. Broke it. This side of Alton Ochsner that other people haven't seen. He's also, remember, he was King Rex. He was the most popular man in town. You don't come against a man like that. This man had power. And now I'm standing before him, and his face is red. His eyes are bulging. The anger, he was seeing red. And when he burst into his imprecations against me, I just swore to myself I was going to take it. I was not going to. But, boy, when he was finished, he said, "You get out of here." And he said, "It's lucky you have your teeth in your damned head." And I turned around and left. My career was over in 3 minutes, you see, like a boiled egg. And I came out, and there's Dave with the car that hardly ever would start on time. The car always had a run-down battery anyway. And something was wrong with the solenoid. I come out there, and I started to cry in his arms. It's the only time Dave's ever put his arms around me. But at another point, he told me I was like the daughter he never had. He was born the same year as my dad, and I was estranged from my father. And here Dave is trying to comfort me. He says, "Well, it's all over now, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm ruined. And they want me never to see Lee again. I've got to go back to Gainesville, Florida. But not until I do this blood test." They had nobody else on earth who could do it or be trained to do it in time. It had to be done within 72 hours. So Lee would eventually, soon drive me out there. And Dr. Oxstream gave me the papers I had to fill out for that stupid blood test. Anyway, it was over. And all the things I wanted to do to help people and help them get cancer cured, I wasn't even allowed to ever, ever, ever get into a lab again. Yet, what happened in New Orleans, and it's very important, when they send me away, in New Orleans, and here's what happened. I had to go to Florida, but they said, "Wait a minute, we've got a problem. If this woman actually... reporters are going to notice what happened in New Orleans. How come she's not doing cancer research anymore?" So they put me into Peninsular Chem Research, and I was working there as a lab assistant. I was doing lots of tests to check the purity of new chemicals, and some of them were very exotic. I was working with gas chromatography, working with lasers, doing all these kinds of tests. After that, though, it was all over, and I was ruined.
How horrible. When did you first become aware of a plot to kill the president? And how did you become aware of this plan?
Well, that happened early on. I mean, they're trying to get me to participate in creating a biological weapon against Castro. And when I walk into Dr. Sherman's apartment, she asked me to come in. There sits David Ferry. By the way, I have what they call a remarkable memory. It's right in the book there. You can see that she opens the door, and then I come in, and there is David Ferry sitting at a table. And why I mention that is that Dr. Sherman did not have a dining room. Right away when you walked in, if she's going to have a meal where a sit-down meal and not at a counter, she had a table in the living room. And I could remember the layout of her apartment and everything. Anyway, there's Dave sitting there. And at first they talked about Mount Everest, so you can get the date right away from that. Mount Everest had been conquered that day. So, and then they turned the conversation to some political material, and finally they start talking to me about a man. They say, "This man is in real trouble because he thinks he's the president of the United States, and he has power, that he's a real president." and his baby brother's causing all kinds of trouble for the mafia, and he's causing all kinds of trouble for the oil people, and he said he's going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and he's going to retire Hoover in a couple of years, and Hoover doesn't want to retire. In fact, Hoover would go on to become director for life under Lyndon Johnson. And they make this list of all the enemies that Kennedy has. They say, you know, what might stop that? Well, what would stop that? What if we got Cuba back? What if Castro was killed? Do you realize the same people who are engaged in all this talk about killing Kennedy, they all want Cuba back because they have interests. The mafia has interests. They forget all about Bobby, at least for a while, you know, getting rid of him, because they want their casinos back. They want their prostitutes back. They want their drug rings back. CIA would be able to move in and get a lot of glory by, you know, securing the Capitol and subduing and getting rid of all the communists. That would make Hoover very happy as well. He could round them all up, and whether they were communists or not, you know, and make a show of it and show how, you know, how powerful he was. We have all these United Fruit, Standard Fruit interests. We have assets there in Cuba, including oil refineries of interest to the oil guys who were losing all that. So if we can just get Cuba back, then they're not going to get rid of Kennedy. They're going to be fighting over Cuba. They're going to be dividing Cuba among themselves. So this is how I was persuaded that it was a good idea to kill Castro. Frankly, it sounded pretty good to me.
So then it sounds like Dr. Mary Sherman was aware all along of a plot to assassinate Kennedy.
Well, all along, I think it all developed that they learned by at least March when we have all of a sudden you have to understand that Dr. Ochsner, who hated Kennedy, was in a peculiar position a year earlier. In 1962, the man was in charge of Kennedy's visit to New Orleans, of all people. He was Dr. Ochsner. He learned so much about the motorcade. He learned about Kennedy's secret medical problems. We know that Kennedy's doctor often sat in the car with him. He'd be the third man, the man in the middle seat, the man where you wouldn't have had a bullet going and hitting Kennedy in the throat. If that man had been sitting there, he would have hit his doctor. And his doctor was placed in a car way, way back, far, far from John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. We know that Ochsner learned everything about the motorcade and how it's set up and the situations. He could do it because he was the doctor, and he was the one who would have to know about Kennedy's medical conditions and needs, potential problems, and so on. He is the one in charge of that motorcade. Did you know that, of that visit? So there we've got connections. We have doctors talking to doctors. We know that Dr. Ochsner's good friend is Clay Shaw, has all these interests for the international trademark. Think about the international trademark, please, for a moment, because Clay Shaw of the international trademark, we have Juan Valdez, worked for the international trademark, is the first one to report that Mary Sherman is dead. He smells smoke. Well, you know, that something's wrong at Mary Sherman's apartment. And he calls. Who does he call? Who do you call when you have fire?
Well, the fire department, you would think.
Well, no, he called the police department, which tells me a lot right there. He called the police department. He's at the international trademark. We have John F. Kennedy is on his way to the international trademark. And Clay Shaw, of course, was involved in this project to help kill Castro. So we have the situation of the death of Castro would have stopped the death of Kennedy. And Mary Sherman had learned a lot of this. She was anti-Castro to the extent she was helping some of these guerrillas out there. They're being trained. She brought the medical supplies. She actually was a contributor to INCA, the Information Council of the Americas. It was run by Ochsner and Ed Butler, and they were sending out propaganda all over Central South America, Mexico, and these were truth tapes. They were propaganda tapes, partially sponsored by the CIA. I could go on and on of how deep they were involved with CIA activities.
Now, would Lee Harvey Oswald have confided in Dr. Mary Sherman about assassination plans against the president in Chicago, the Chicago business, and how they saved President Kennedy in Chicago?
Yes, we'll finish with that. the Chicago plot, the way it looks now, with Mary's many contacts that she had in Chicago for years, people she trusted, also the fact that she knew people who are connected with the CIA and the FBI. There's no doubt about that. And we have someone who would have talked, and I think that's, of course, what got her killed on the 21st of July when she was found murdered the same day the Warren Commission came to get unsolicited testimonies. So we have that situation. She had the ability to get information and connected with, also with David Ferry, put the two together. That was quite a bit of an asset because David, of course, was working for the mafia with Carlos Marcello. And, of course, he had all these contacts there with, like, Sam Giancana and so on up there in the Chicago area. And here's the plot to kill Kennedy. It's afoot. And the information is there. Lee Oswald learns about it because they can't do that directly. Lee takes it upon himself to make the calls, to make the decision to tell them they arrest armed men there. We have Abraham Bolden still in Chicago now in that same area who tells us that it was a man named Lee who gave them the information.
You mean the information to prevent an assassination of the president?
Absolutely.
In Chicago?
Yes. Yes.
Just one last clarification. Do you think that Dr. Mary Sherman was the target of the sabotage of the linear particle accelerator?
This happened the day that the Warren Commission came. They knew who she was, but unfortunately for all of us, you know, even though Dave Ferry and Lee, and of course, eventually were also murdered and killed, others too, she cares about her country. And she wants to save the president if she can. You bet that something had to be done about Mary Sherman.
Judith Ferry Baker, thank you so much.
Well, I'm very pleased that I have been able to at least speak with you for a little while. God bless you, and maybe we can talk again.
I've been speaking with Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show has been The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. Judith Ferry Baker is an author, teacher, and an artist, and was once a promising young science prodigy who hoped one day to find a cure for cancer. Recruited to New Orleans in the spring of 1963 to do cancer research, she instead was assigned to an underground laboratory project to develop a cancer-causing bioweapon. Early on in the summer of 1963, during her work in New Orleans, she learned of plans to kill the president. She is the author of two nonfiction personal memoirs, Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, and David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, Participant in Anti-Castro Bioweapon Plot, Friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, and Key to the JFK Assassination. Visit meandlee.com. judithbaker.blogspot.com and david-ferry.com. That's meandlee.com, judithbaker.blogspot.com, and david-ferry.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner. To make comments or order copies of shows, email me at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's FAULKNER at GUNSANDBUTTER.ORG. Visit our transitional website at gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio. That's GANDBRADIO.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Progressive political scientist Michael Parenti is back, and he's in fine form. Here he's speaking ad lib, and he's wise, shrewd, and funny. I hope you'll stay tuned. When I began New World Notes about 8 years ago, I expected to play a lot of political scientist Michael Parenti. In fact, we've played him less frequently than I expected, but we will hear from him again today. I have to thank Mariah Gillardin and her fine show, TUC Radio, for acquainting me with Parenti a couple decades back. Parenti helped me to make sense of a lot of random ideas and observations that I just couldn't get to add up. Ideas and observations about the U.S. government's domestic and especially foreign policies, which never made sense to me. Here are some of the clarifying ideas I got from Michael Parenti. First, don't conclude that U.S. foreign policy is stupid or crazy or counterproductive. People do things for a reason. And relatedly, don't confuse a government's statement of its noble motives and noble purposes for the real reasons behind a policy. Government policy seems stupid and crazy and counterproductive only if you believe the official statement of what its motives and purposes are. Like, the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to promote freedom and democracy around the world. The goal of our military interventions is to protect American lives. We bombed the hell out of Belgrade, Serbia, in order to save the lives of innocent Muslim civilians in Kosovo. Parenti says the reason that our military interventions and other foreign policies make no sense to you is that you're taking seriously the government's public statement of its noble purposes. Parenti advises that the actual motive and purpose of most of our policies is to increase the profits of the Fortune 500. And one of my favorite Parenti quotes, just because you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean that they don't know what they're doing. This is what I learned from Michael Parenti, and I believe he is right. For what it's worth, Parenti is now 82 years old. He gave a nice talk in Springfield, Illinois on October 6, 2015. It was titled Capitalism Versus Reality. We shall hear the talk in good time, but today I'm going to broadcast parts of the question and answer session that followed. Parenti talks about whether universities and students can still be a force for progressive change. He talks about Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders is a good liberal Democrat, Parenti thinks, but not much of a socialist. Parenti talks about the oppressiveness of Wall Street and whether socialism could possibly work. Here, speaking off the cuff, Parenti is in fine form. He's funny and witty and wise and very shrewd. The original sound recording was quite mediocre. I've been able to improve it, but there's still some audio distortion in places. He's speaking at a university, and the first question he is asked is whether universities can still be a force for progressive change, or are they hopelessly corrupted?
Well, that's another thing they did, that is they've taken students
Students have been a very political activist group, social group in America. If you go back to the Vietnam War, and you even go back during the Depression and such, students often showed up and fought for good causes. What we got now, though, are students who are getting crushed by debts. You know, it's hard to go out there and spend weeks organizing and such when you got $75,000 debt that comes up when you graduate next week.
So the question was, with the privatization of public universities and universities in general, do you think that the university still has a role to play in what you've called substantive democracy?
Yes. Universities throughout history, not just here but in Europe and such, have always had a role to play. The youth are people who know the score. They are exposed to the contradictions of the situation. And they often have very idealistic commitments. They do. I remember that during the Vietnam War. I wasn't a student. I already was a teacher, and I would get up there, and we'd get on a line and face the cops down, and it wasn't for. And we were characterized as just a bunch of vandals, just a bunch of blowhards, and stupid and obscene and potheads and so forth and so on. I mean, so who do we face? We face these cops who are heavy drinkers and got clubs in their hands and want to beat up defenseless. They're very brave. They're very brave when the other side has no armament or anything. Then they're ready to hit and kill, as we still see today, don't we? So my answer is yes. The plutocrats always saw the students as a problem, and as people who agitate and confront things, and there are too many of them all in once gathered all in one place, and that's dangerous. Did I answer your question somewhat? The board of trustees of these universities are just like the board of trustees from corporations. They're made up of big company guys, mm-hmm. General Motors, General this, General that, and the other thing. And they get paid the salaries. You know better than me about the recent times, right? They're getting paid quite a bit. I won't put you on the spot. I know you're still working here. That's right. It's good to associate now and then with someone who has a job, I can tell you. makes me feel good, you know.
The question is, what is Dr. Parenti's view of Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie and I were very close friends for years. He'd come over to my house when I lived in Washington, D.C. He came with this kid, with his son once, and my son was visiting me. I made them dinner. Bernie and I both ran on the Liberty Union ticket in Vermont. I ran for the House of Representatives. Vermont has only one congressman, so you can't get gerrymandered out. But it meant I'd go up and down the whole state, and I got 7% of the vote. Bernie ran for Senate, U.S. Senate. He got 2% of the vote. Not that I'm trying to commit. And very close to Bernie. His last words to me, I remember when he came to, it was right in Berkeley, California, when I was living there. Bernie came to Oakland, and he said, "Where have you been? I haven't seen you. Stay in touch with me." I said, "Oh, sure, I will, Bernie." But then came the Yugoslav War, and Bernie sided with President William Clinton and supported the bombing of Yugoslavia, 78 days and nights. Depleted uranium, which has left Serbia today with the highest cancer rate in all of Europe. I vigorously opposed that war and wrote a book about it called To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia. And Bernie, as I told Huck was a good friend, I forget Huck's last name, he was a professor from the university who took a leave to go work in Bernie's office when Bernie was now in the House of Representatives. Bernie went to the House of Representatives. He got elected mayor of Burlington and then House of Representatives and then the U.S. Senate. And now he's doing this try for the presidency. What was I saying? Just Yugoslav war, yeah. I said he's standing shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the White House and Bill Clinton and these creepos for war against these people like this. I said and that's when I broke with him. I stopped sending contributions. I stopped. Furthermore, his salary was way bigger than what I was making. So when I saw that he was running, you know, and I put on the little thing to see some of the events with 10,000 people, I must admit, I sat there, and it was very touching, and I was so happy to see it. I was very happy to see Bernie getting up there, 10,000 people, and the powers that be have to deal with him in some way now. It's like a big blister in the way, and they got to deal with him and say, and mostly they don't say too much. They just concentrate on Donald Trump. But, I think it's great. The trouble is he's still not saying anything about foreign policy. He's still not criticizing. The empire feeds off the republic. We don't need an empire with 700 military bases all over the world. We don't need to be fighting 2, 3, 4, 5 wars at the same time. This is crazy. That's all. Bernie hasn't said a word about those things. He hasn't. He's just not said anything about it. So he's good on local issues. He's really, I think, he's a liberal Democrat. He's not a socialist or not even really a left progressive. He's just sort of he'd be a good liberal Democrat. But look at what he says. He says, and we want the rich to pay their share too. What do you mean? We want to stop having the rich rule our lives and rule our minds. That's what we want. And I think he could do a lot better on that, and he's going to have to say it's not just me. I was alone years ago about his position on foreign policy, but a number of other people have brought it up now too. So he will have to start saying something about foreign policy, which would put him at odds with the National Security State boys who play for keep. When you get into arguments with them, you got to be careful about your plane crashing or your car skidding and going off the road or a lone assassin coming over and killing you, you know, as John Lennon happened to him, remember? And a few others, supposedly. Please stand up and speak louder because I'm 82 years old and I am 82 and I can't hear him.
The question is, what are some things that we can do to combat or counteract the control of capital, of money, over our lives? Is that fair? Okay, thank you.
We could go through this talk again and pick out things. We could get rid of the $40, $50, $60 billion direct subsidies that are given to corporate America for export supports, for equity freebies, all sorts of things that they get. Look at the farm bill every 2 years. My God, the payoff. And it doesn't go to poor Joe the farmer or Joe the plumber. It goes to big agribusiness. That's who. So you can stop doing that. You could start organizing the work in a more communal and communitarian way. And we have evidence that Americans are quite capable of doing communitarian work. You don't have to be a Chinese peasant who does it from feudal times or something or other. People of all sorts immediately see where their interests are, and they have skills and all that, and they could do those things. So that's what I would say. I would say we'd have to start moving away. Look, this system wouldn't survive if it wasn't the federal government pumping it and giving it what it is. One of the things that the capitalist system needs, what the government is there for, is to protect the capitalists from the capitalists. As I said, one capitalist can kill many capitalists. It's a cannibalistic system too. So these are some of the things you would do, and there are others too. It's an interesting question. You could start, because you already have people doing it. Gar Alperovitz has written a number of books on this about the worker communitarian ways that workers who own their own factories and work for a non-profit. Everybody gets a salary. So maybe some people who have more responsibilities and longer hours will get a little more salary. But there are thousands of workers in America who work in worker-owned businesses. And that could tell you then how it could be done. And they'd be perfectly right and with regulations to make sure that these products are safe. Because you could have workers producing something that's not safe either, you know.
Question is to get some of your thoughts on the stock market, on financial capital.
It's shameful that people who have worked hard and saved their money then have to gamble it on the market because they realize they don't have enough and they're going to drop dead in a year or two. They got to hope that they'll drop dead in a year or two so that they can not be penniless or end up out on the sidewalk. And so they go into the market and they do that. And it's true that as people get older, but they're getting poorer, the way the system is rigged, that contradiction is going to get more intense. And the market becomes a place where people hope they can make money without working. That's what the capitalist does. And it's a big gamble. It's a big shoot. But the people who are most successful at it are the people who spend all their time with it and who have diversity of investments. The Warren Buffett said, you know, he's most successful. You guys all are going out and you're taking a dive and your stock is worthless. I'll buy it up. Why will I buy it up? I'll buy it up because I can get it for a penny. And then once it starts climbing back up again, I'll sell it. So you sell when your stuff is going high. You sell then. And when it's going low and it's going out, and then you buy those. That's what you buy. That's how Buffett made his billions. And so the whole thing becomes a casino game, you know. Might as well go to Vegas because it's a terrible way to have to end your life, struggling in that manner.
On New World Notes, we're hearing Michael Parenti speaking ad lib on economics and world affairs. He's in Springfield, Illinois, on October 10, 2015. There's a rambling, unfocused question, and Parenti's answer is a bit rambling, too. I think it's worth hearing, though, because it has some nice insights into socialism versus capitalism. Indeed, insights into some of the problems with socialism, at least the way socialism was practiced in Cuba and the Soviet Union. The questioner said that capitalism brings innovation, which we do need, and socialism cannot work because people are greedy and flawed. Michael Parenti responds.
It is because people are imperfect that you don't build a system that feeds their imperfections and harms their perfections, that people who want to help, want to do things, want to make it all fair and square, they get into trouble, they get unrewarded, they often get punished, whereas the people who pursue money in the most treacherous and amoral ways, they get benefited. And you're telling me about them. You're saying, we can't do without them. You got it in your brain that we can't do without the people who steal and deceive and plunder and produce and innovate. They do innovate in many ways. Adolf Hitler innovated too, and there was innovations in communist countries. I'm sure some of those things were. I went to Cuba and I saw things they did, and I saw other things they didn't like and all that. And it should be open and be able to be debated. That's why I called for services. Cuba's already doing some of that, services and such, instead of letting everything be held by the government. That's impossible. You can't do that. But the government, you need a government that is going to help parse out things fair and square. And I think they do. They do that. I was just thinking, for instance, one of the small businesses they have in Cuba are women's hairdressers, beauty parlors. There are women's beauty parlors. They're held in women's houses, you know, and all that. And it's allowed. And the communist government had to back off. Don't get between a woman and her hair, you know. A woman's hair is an ongoing dynamic all the time. And So you can see how innovations, you can see things that are wrong. I was talking about plumbers who were terrible in Cuba. They go and they fix here and leave it draining over there, and they don't care. They go home. Restaurants in the Soviet Union, restaurants, I mean, the last thing you want to do as a restaurant manager is have a big clientele that likes your food. They come a lot, and you got to serve it to them and all that. The less I have to serve out, the more I can take home and black market. That would be a kind of example of what you're talking about. Well, how do you stop that? Well, you can stop that. You can have social services. My position is where small business can operate, then have small businesses. And restaurants would be one example, because the last thing the restaurant owners in Russia wanted to do was to please a lot of people and serve them out. The less I served out, the more I had to sell on the black market or take home from my family and neighbors or whatever. It was a corrupt thing. And there are mythologies about it, too. I mean, they thought things were so perfect, and they weren't perfect. But don't forget, the Soviet Union, there's not a single socialist country that didn't produce its world not being under fire. They all were under fire all the time. The Soviet Union's history, you look at just about every year in its history, and there was a crisis, there was invasions from the West, there was war, there was civil wars. There wasn't one normal year where these people could sit and work it out for themselves and for each other. They couldn't do that. And so they also would compensate with myths about their country. Like, I remember when I was in Moscow, our guide, she said, there's no prostitution in my country. I said, what? What? No prostitution? This is a country of, what, like, almost 400 million people at that time. No prostitution? I said, well, there may not be any prostitution in your country, but there's quite a bit in our hotel here. And then without missing a beat, she says, yes, I want you to know all those girls have day jobs and they work too. I said, oh, that fixes, that settles it. There's a little extra change here. We could go on with your questions. Mm-hmm. And it's a good question, though. Yeah.
Question about how does organization look when you're organizing to confront mythologies? Is that fair? So if a part of what we have to do is confront the capitalist mythology, how would we do it? What are some ways that we might be able to do that?
First thing is we have to inform ourselves about what's going on. What is Monsanto? Why do they do these things? Or why aren't these people being shot? You know, we have to ask those questions. No. Did I say that? I'm so tired.
Did I mention the mic was hot?
Yeah. Oh, I was on? Oh, my God. Yeah, no, Monsanto is a wicked, evil corporation. It really is among the worst. So you're saying that people are not developing a critical perspective of how this thing operates? Is that what it would... I remember a construction worker. It was in Vermont, as a matter of fact, back when I was doing union support work there. He looked at one of the brochures for the Liberty Union Party, which Bernie Sanders was running into, took the paper, and he saw our program, this. He says, these are all good ideas except this last one. You know what the last one had? It had a word socialism in it, that we could adopt certain forms of democratic socialism so that people can all participate, blah, blah, blah. That he didn't know what the hell socialism was. He was accepting it in the actual content, public transportation, public utilities. But then he was afraid of a word, and they've got us afraid. That's why I think it's really terrific of Bernie to come out and say, yes, I'm a socialist. But then when he gets into particulars, socialist means put a little more taxes on the rich, or put a lot more taxes on the rich and less on people who can barely make it now. I mean, that any good liberal would support that, you would think, if there were still some good liberals left in American politics. I don't know.
One, two, three, four. First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you. They're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change. So quick. The congressmen and businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times, the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you. How it can spread out like a net, and everything can change. So quick. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change. So quick. Everything can change.
David Rovics. And before that, Michael Parenti, speaking ad lib on socialism, capitalism, universities, Russian prostitutes, Bernie Sanders, and whatnot. We'll have more, probably next week. Thanks to the University of Illinois at Springfield, and to Dale Lehman of radio station WZRD for the original recording, which I have edited. Thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. Thanks to that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford, for making possible the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, whence New World Notes emanates more or less. Thanks to the dozen or so community broadcast stations, coast to coast, that also carry the show. And if hearing us on the air isn't convenient for you, you can always grab our podcast. You can grab it at the show's website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust. Thank you again for listening. Illegitimate non-carborundum. Question authority. And please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, the host. And joining us on the line is Professor Isaac Saini of Dalhousie University and author of Cuba, Revolution in Motion. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. And thank you for having me again on your program, Phil. I always enjoy it.
Okay. Well, we certainly are glad to be talking to you because on November 13th and 14th at the United Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, there's going to be a special event, Africa's Children Return, Cuba and Africa, African Liberation. And, of course, you're one of the principal organizers of it, along with a different book list and others. Tell us about this. Cuba has a very – I know this is your area's expertise. Cuba has a relationship to Africa that most of the world doesn't – I should say academia doesn't actually realize. And what is the focus of the program and you're hoping to accomplish?
Well, November 5th of this year will represent the 40th anniversary of Cuba's international solidarity or military mission in Angola to help Angola repel invasion from racist South Africa, the apartheid state at that time. Mm-hmm. So over a 15-year period, this is the length of the Cuban mission, over 330,000 Cubans served as soldiers to defend Angolan independence and also to participate in the Southern African liberation struggles. So this was an immense undertaking by a small, poor, undeveloped so-called third world nation. And it's important to understand, and I think it's important here to quote Nelson Mandela, and this is what he said. And he said, the Cuban people hold a special place in the hearts of the peoples of Africa. The Cuban internationalists have made a contribution to African independence, freedom, and justice unparalleled for its principled and selfless character. Cubans came to our regions as doctors, teachers, soldiers, agricultural experts, but never as colonizers. They have shared the same trenches with us in the struggles against colonialism, underdevelopment, and apartheid. Hundreds of Cubans have given their lives, literally in a struggle that was first and foremost not theirs, but ours. As Southern Africans, we salute them. We vow never to forget this unparalleled example of selfish internationalism. So the 40th anniversary is upon us, and I think as we now enter the United Nations International Decade for People of African Descent, the subject of Africa's Children Return, Cuban African Liberation, assumes great poignancy and relevance. And we will actually have, as one of the principal, in fact, the keynoter for the conference, is Nicolas Hernandez Guyen, who is a major Afro-Cuban scholar, and he's president of the Nicolas Guyen Foundation. He is the grandson of the very internationally acclaimed and famous, the huge poet, Nicolas Guyen. So he's the grandson of Nicolas Guyen. He's sort of his namesake, who was Cuba's national laureate, poet laureate, and is renowned for the beauty of his poetry and his political stance that he did take. He's an international figure. So Guyen will be talking about Africa and Cuban. This is Nicolas Hernandez Guyen, his grandson, who's a major scholar in his own right, will be talking about the African-Cuban relationship, the impact of Africa on Cuba, and why hundreds of thousands of Cubans are willing to demonstrate such a profound solidarity with Africa, especially in Angola. So that's the Friday night, which starts at 7 p.m. at United Steelworkers Hall on November 13th, will commemorate Cuba's role in African liberation struggles with a tribute also to the late Jorge Risquet, who passed away just about a couple of weeks ago, who was a historic member of Cuba's revolutionary leadership and a participant in the African anti-colonial national liberation struggles. As you may remember, Phil, we had him here as a special guest, a special honored guest in September of 2013, when we did another event focusing on a series of major battles in Southern Africa that Cuba played a critical role in that accelerated the end of apartheid. On Saturday, from in the morning and in the afternoon, starting at 9:30 and running to about 4:30, we're going to have more detailed workshops dealing on Cuba's role in African liberation struggle and current solidarity in Africa. So we have a film, Cuba and African Liberation Struggles. We have a workshop, Guilty of Defending Africa, Soweto de Quito Cuanaval, Cuba and the War to Liberate Southern Africa. We have a very special presentation by John Cook, who is one of the leading specialists on Cuba in Canada, and he's the author of the acclaimed book, Healthcare Without Borders, Understanding Cuban Medical Internationalism. Cuba has more doctors serving abroad than anybody else, and he'll be talking about Cuba and Ebola, yet another example of Cuban medical internationalism. And then we'll have a panel discussion looking at discussions on the current liberation struggles in Africa, like Burkina Faso and so forth. So it's a wide-ranging discussion that seeks to basically put in historical context and pay tribute and commemorate Cuba's immense mission, as well as placing it in a local context, a current context.
Mm-hmm. This is Professor Isaac Saini, who, of course, is the coordinator of this event. By the way, I'll just tell our listeners, you can go to a different book list or call them at 416-538-0889 and to get more information and to indicate that you will be attending.
And it's a free event, I should mention to people. It's a free event.
It's just phenomenal. You know, you're saying the grandson of Nicolas Guillen. I mean, yeah. It's kind of like it's maybe to get people oriented here. This is like the grandson of Walt Whitman. This is or Pablo Neruda. This is and he will be. Is it Friday? He'll be speaking at Stewart.
He'll be speaking Friday. He'll be there Saturday as well. He's quite a significant scholar in his own right, following in his grandfather's footsteps. He's not a poet per se, of course, but he's a scholar. And he's basically going to elucidate this relationship of Cuba and Africa, and also using his father's relationship with the late president of Angola, Agostinho Neto, who led Angola to independence, as being sort of the fulcrum, right, of his discussion of why so many Cubans, right? What is this profound historical connection between Cuba and Africa, and why this profound historical connection found such a profound and beautiful expression of solidarity when the Cuban Revolution triumphed.
And it really clarifies the strength of this country. I mean, when the U.S. has tried always to portray the relationship as the great, super, sleek, modern power and this poor country that it's trying to discipline. But 300,000 Cubans went to engaged in this struggle in Angola, and a successful one against the apartheid regime. That is a story the chapter in history needs to be emphasized. So, it is so striking. And by the way, a loss of lives. I think you have, is it 2,000, 5,000 casualties?
Yeah, 2,000 Cubans. About 2,500 gave their lives in liberation struggles across Africa, and about 2,000 in Southern Africa alone.
And they thwarted a plan, which had it succeeded, I mean, all these struggles in that region would have been lost.
Yeah. You know, what they did was they stopped the racist apartheid state of South Africa from achieving regional domination. If they had achieved that, what would have happened would have been the South African apartheid state would have had extended its life. Mm-hmm. And it's important to understand that the battle to liberate South Africa took place as much outside its borders as inside. And in fact, many times more people died outside its borders, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa acknowledged that. Hundreds of thousands of lives were destroyed, not only in terms of loss of life, but in terms of, people who were lacerated, who were maimed, right? As well as the immense economic damage was done by South Africa's war of terror that basically economically sabotaged the region. It's in that context that Cuba expressing its solidarity with Africa, expressing its what it said was its debt to Africa, that there is a debt to be played, that humanity owes a debt to Africa, that Cuba went to Africa. And it's important to understand that I like to quote here Amical Cabral, who many people will know as a celebrated leader of the anti-colonial national liberation struggles in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, one of the great intellectuals of the 20th century and a tremendous loss to Africa. And he said when Cuba began, helping the liberation movements in Africa, and particularly aiding Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde in training with doctors and so forth, and, also providing military advisors. And this is what Cabral said. He said, "I don't believe in life after death, but if there is, we can be sure that the souls of our forefathers who were taken away to America to be slaves are rejoicing today to see their children reunited and working together to help us be independent and free." And so in a sense, that sort of provides the context of why we entitled the conference Africa's Children Return. So we're placing Cuba not only in the context of aiding other people who are involved in national and social liberation, but also as part of the African diaspora, one section of the African diaspora coming to aid the motherland of Africa. So we're placing it in that kind of context, but we're also looking at Cuba's ongoing solidarity with Africa. So one thing that Jorge Risquet said in a speech a few years ago, the late great Jorge Risquet, was that at one point when the national anti-colonial liberation struggles were raging throughout Africa, Cuba sent military advisors, and in the case of Angola, for example, sent soldiers to defend Angola's independence from racist apartheid South Africa. But he also said, we now, in this context, we send doctors, we send teachers, and so forth. So Cuba's solidarity has changed form, but not changed content. Yeah. And, for example, John Kirk will be presenting on Cuba's immense contribution to the fight against Ebola in West Africa.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Isaac Saini, and the event is, by the way, November 13th and 14th, United Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. You can go to a different book list to learn more. And, of course, the number that, at the different book list, 416-538-0889. And make sure you attend, because Friday, as you begin Friday at November 13th at 7 p.m., and it'll be, I guess it's Dr. Guillen will be speaking.
Yeah. Yes.
And he will also be attending on Saturday, and that begins, that's November the 14th, from 10 a.m.
Yeah.
To 4 p.m. And it's Africa's Children Return, Cuba and Africa, African Liberation. Could you tell us a little more about it was really remarkable. You had Mr. Risque at the event only 2 years ago, and he's a very big figure in all this. Give us a little outline of his life and role, if you could.
Well, he was an immensely modest and humble person, and he always said he was just performing his duty, right? His duty not only to the Cuban Revolution, because he was a revolutionary, but his duty to the struggle of humanity. But his role was a very significant one. He was Cuba's chief representative, chief diplomat in Africa in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and advising and playing an important role. What happens is that basically a central role he plays is in the negotiation process that took place between South Africa, Angola, the United States, and Cuba, that eventually led to the independence of Namibia, which had been illegally occupied by South Africa since 1916, and which had been waging an independent struggle, right, against racist rule to achieve black majority rule. Mm-hmm. This is what comes out of this and eventually accelerates the end of apartheid. So within this whole context, he was the main Cuban negotiator, and he played a very important role because at this stage, the South Africans, as some people may know, had launched a major offensive in 1987 to rescue what could only be described as their puppets, their surrogates, which was UNITA, run by UNITA Vimbi in Angola. And once they had achieved such an immense early military success that they decided they could now achieve a sort of like a knockout blow, deliver a fatal blow to the Angolan government, and therefore transform Angola into sort of a puppet state. Mm-hmm. And in this context, Cuba increased its military assistance, sent more reinforcements, and delivered a decisive military defeat to the Southern African forces. This altered the balance of power on the ground and basically allowed Cuba to enter the negotiations which the United States had been opposing, because there was a fear that what would happen is that the Cubans would now go into Namibia and drive down to South Africa, and what we would have would be a revolutionary overthrow of the Southern African government. The mm-hmm. Cubans wanted to avoid further bloodshed. They had won on the battlefield, but they wanted this to be settled at the negotiation table. And what happened was, out of this, South Africa had to give up its control of Namibia. And once it did that, it basically signaled the end of the apartheid state. Nelson Mandela himself acknowledged this and so forth, and acknowledged that, basically speaking, it was a Cuban military role which forced these negotiation process, which worked to the favor of the Southern African people, which accelerated not only his liberation, but the eventual dismantling of apartheid, whatever problems may arise later on. Mm-hmm. But Namibia ties its independence to those struggles. And Jorge Risquet played a very important role in those negotiations. At one point, Chester Crocker, who was a chief U.S. diplomat in those negotiations, trying to defend, apartheid South Africa in many ways, comes up to Risquet, and he plaintively asks, are the Cuban troops going to advance from Angola into Namibia, right? Because he's worried about the consequences.
Yes.
And Risquet tells him, well, I can't give you a tranquilizer, right? In a sense, I'm not going to give you something to calm you down. I'm not going to tell you whether they're going to go in or not going, right? The point is, this has to be resolved at the negotiating table. And Fidel Castro actually gives a very important speech in June of 1988. This is when these negotiations are going on, in the summer of 1988. And he says, you know, basically speaking, you know, he talks about this, the so-called superiorists, the white South Africans who believed they were invincible and they were superior, had been beaten by black Angolans and also primarily by black Cubans and what the South Africans were considered mixed-race Cubans. So the superior race had suffered a significant setback. And as Castro said, you know, this basically, you know, signals the end of apartheid because he says this has begun the process of negotiations, right? Mm-hmm. The apartheid has now been dealt its fatal blow. He talks about this very clearly and very presciently. So the negotiation process in which Risket played a very central role, even though he always liked to diminish his role because of his humility, really sets in stage the end of the apartheid.
Yeah, we can't allow people who do great things to just walk off. We can't. It's nice that they are humble, but we have to, like your program is going to do, underline what work they did do.
Yeah.
And the success of it.
Yeah. He always liked to say, you know, he was following, you know, he was a loyal Cuban, a soldier of the Cuban Revolution. And that basically speaking, you know, he was just following Fidel Castro's instructions, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he played a much more important role than that, right? And the Cubans would acknowledge that. But it's a hallmark of the humility of Cubans.
Yeah.
For example, I'll give you two examples that have nothing directly to do with the conference, but we just had the Interior Minister of Cuba, Senor Colomé, who just retired. And, you know, he was a very important figure in the Cuban Revolution. He just spoke, I did my duty. That's all I did, right? Mm-hmm. And yesterday, as everyone well knows, the United Nations once again overwhelmingly voted in support of Cuba, 191 countries to two, only the United States and Israel opposing this resolution that supported Cuba against the economic war of Cuba. Economic warfare waged by the United States against Cuba. And I had a conversation with the Cuban ambassador, and I said, this is the work of you and your diplomats, your hardworking Cuban diplomats. And they said, no, this is basically the work of the people, right? They're very humble, right? And we see that in terms of Cuba's commitment to the African liberation struggles. Mm-hmm. They participated in it because they said that humanity had an unpaid debt to Africa and Cuba could make its modest contributions to African liberation.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, I think that humility is part of the secret of their success. It's the old thing of the proposition that you accomplish more if you don't worry about who's going to get credit.
Yeah.
This is Professor Isaac Saini, and the event is November 13 and 14, United Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. On Friday, it begins at 7 p.m., and Saturday at 11, running to 4 p.m. And, of course, there's going to be this film. Who made this film, by the way?
Well, it's basically a film people have put together. It's a BBC documentary, but it's also other people.
Did you say BBC?
Well, BBC did a documentary called Cuba African Revolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we've asked permission to show it for educational purposes because this is a free event.
Okay.
And it has interviews with Jorge Risket and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to emphasize it, underline. Here you have, again, this great power that always says that it's in charge of everything, the U.S., and increasingly the world is objecting to this. They announce that they're going to fight terrorism, and then we notice that other people seem to be better at it than they are. And they also were going to take on the leadership in fighting Ebola. But again, here we move from military matters in the case of Ebola to skill and capacity and willingness. And it turns out the Cubans are exemplary. Could you talk just a little bit about that? Because that's part of your program, too, on November 13 and 14 at the Steelworkers
Hall. Well, the Cubans responded almost instantly to the Ebola issue, right? They called a regional meeting of Latin American Caribbean states to discuss, you know, how best to confront Ebola. They sent the contingent. They had a couple doctors who got sick with Ebola while they were in West Africa and got treated and then returned, right, to continue the fight. So Cuba made an immense contribution to the struggle against Ebola, bringing in medicines, setting up tents, and so forth, right? And, you know, basically, people hear about Doctors Without Borders, hear about other people, but the Cubans provided the largest single contingent. Even the United States basically acknowledged this as well, right? The New York Times acknowledged it as well. And it was the largest single contribution of a country in terms of medical practitioners to carry on this fight. And the goal has always been not just simply to put medical practitioners on the ground, but also to build the healthcare systems of those particular countries. So Cuba not only basically provided assistance in terms of directly fighting Ebola, but also shoring up the healthcare system in those respective countries. Last year, we had a tour of Dr. Portilla, who was a very important person in shaping Cuba's medical internationalist missions, a very historic figure. And he spoke about Cuba's immense contribution, right, to fight against Ebola. John Kirk will be talking about this, right, Cuban Ebola, yet another example of Cuban medical internationalism. To basically place this in the context that Cuba has long had, since the beginning of the revolution, a commitment to medical internationalism. In fact, during the Algerian national liberation struggle in North Africa, Cuba sent in 1960 a contingent of doctors, even though they had very few doctors in the island at that time.
So it's the very first years of the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah, very first year. Amazing. It's amazing, right? So Cuba's contribution to the fight against Ebola was immense. I mean, they had doctors. I mean, initially they sent well over 300 doctors and nurses and other medical personnel to carry on this fight with tents, with medicine, and so forth. And as everyone knows, Ebola is an extremely contagious disease and extremely virulent and has a high fatality rate. And yet even these people who had caught it and then eventually recovered, right, went back to fight.
Yeah, and the courage of putting your doctors right in the field, because we noticed that on the side of the U.S., most of the personnel turned out to be military personnel,
yeah,
if my
military
memory is right. And the first thing they wanted to do was sort of make sure they had sealed it off from anybody.
Yeah.
You know, eventually, true medical professionals have to walk right into the situation. Otherwise, it's not going to be solved.
Yeah. Well, for Cuba, the important point is simply this, is that there is this unpaid debt to Africa. And the whole point about this unpaid debt to Africa is that, you know, Cuba can play and can make a contribution to this because of the transatlantic slave trade and so forth. So there's this profound feeling that there is a debt to Africa, and that, you know, Cuba, with its modest resources, will do its best to repay that debt.
Yeah. And really, it ought to be John Kirk, he will be speaking on Saturday about this.
Yes, he'll be speaking on Saturday about this. And as I said, his book, Healthcare Without Borders, right? Understanding Cuban Medical Internationalism, is a book based on over maybe 10 years of interviewing Cuban doctors, right? Of going where Cuban doctors have worked and so forth, right? So it's an immense accomplishment. It's an immense book that documents the scale, the dimensions, right, of Cuba's medical internationalism, but also where do these roots come from, right? How can a small, poor country like Cuba have, over 30,000 doctors at any one time?
And making them available to other poor countries.
Yeah, making them available.
And even training Americans, is it my reference?
Well, they don't charge when they're in, they don't charge for the services of their doctors, right, in the poorest of the countries, right? It's seen as simply an elemental duty of revolutionary solidarity, right, of your commitment to creating a better world.
Yeah.
Speak. So the Cubans always like to say, otro mundo mejor es posible, which is a better world is possible. Or otro mejor mundo es posible, depending on however you want to say it.
Yeah. And by the way, we were mentioning books. Professor Saini has a book, Cuba, Revolution in Motion, which I assume will also be, I hope, will be available at this
event.
Well,
it should be. And also what I'm doing as well.
You always go to the different book list.
Yeah, different book list. And in fact, I've been long working on a book on Cuba's role in African liberation struggles, right? And I'm just finished the title of the conference, Africa's Children Return, is actually the title of my book.
Ah, well, it's very apropos. Listeners should go to a different book list in Toronto, and the number there is 416-538-0889. But you can also contact Professor Isaac Saini, 902-494-8810, to indicate to get more information and, of course, to arrange to attend.
Yeah.
It will be November 13 and 14
yep.
at the United Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, beginning Friday evening at at 7 p.m., and the grandson of Nicolas Guillen is speaking.
Yeah, Nicolas Hernandez Guillen is a significant Afro-Cuban scholar in his right, very important person, will be, and he's the president of Nicolas Guillen Foundation, the grandson of the great Nicolas Guillen, and he will be discussing Cuba and African connections. Right?
I have to confess, I'm a great fan, of course, of the poetry of Nicolas Guillen, and I'm so that would put me in a category. I would go just to look at him. I don't care if he writes poetry. I want to look at the grandson of Nicolas Guillen.
Well, yeah, I mean, Guillen is such an immense figure, right, in Latin America, right, and in the African diaspora, the Black Atlantic, right, that he crisscrosses these things. And he had and Nicolas Guillen, the poet, the great poet, had a relationship with Agostinho Neto, right, and had a vision of Cuba and Africa, right. So he's going to be talking about.
So he's one of the creators of the of the policy in in that sense.
Yeah,
And of course, and John Kirk will be speaking Saturday.
I will be speaking as well, and so forth. And the topics on Saturday, you know, Cuban African national liberation struggles, that's one workshop, Guilty of Defending Africa, Soweto de Quito Carnaval, Cuba and the War to Liberate Southern Africa, and Cuba and Ebola, yet another example of Cuban medical internationalism, and the last one will be current liberation struggles in Africa.
Well, we are all looking forward to that.
Isaac
Chaney, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil. It's always a pleasure being on your program, and all the best.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Isaac Chaney. You're listening to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I wish I could talk as fast as Isaac Chaney. I'm trying. Phil, we had some items. You wanted to mention... I guess it's just that we want people to...
Just get ready. Go to the website. Don't wait till next week. You can go right now, CIUT.FM. There's a little virtual button on the website where you can press it and put your credit card information in, and the station will have your money 1 minute later. And why wait? Do it now.
Yeah.
And mention the Taylor Report.
Mention the Taylor Report. And Yelena, if you're listening, make sure you do that. We need your help. It is community radio, and... We have been doing this for a number of years, and very solid support. And, you know, like today, okay, we had Thomas Mountain, Eritrea. That is really going halfway around the world to get the news. And, of course, Isaac Chaney, a brilliant guy, and he also reminds us of something that people don't think about, which is that Cuba played a major role in the ending of apartheid. And it was hands-on work because they had to fight off the South African government.
Yeah, you didn't read that in the Toronto Star, I'll bet.
You did not get that. That's right. You will not find that in the Star, Globe, et cetera. Phil and I were just talking. There is a Saudi prince with a plane load of cocaine who's been stopped in Lebanon. I didn't find that in the Toronto Star either because, you know, now they regard the monarchs of the Gulf as part of the liberation struggle, you know, for the world. And we don't talk about these princes who have plane loads of drugs and of course, in a country where they behead people for being writing poetry that is unflattering of the king or whipping them to death, et cetera. So now Mr. Trudeau is in. He inherits – those are our friends in the Great War to try to destroy Syria. That's a terrible story. So you're listening, as I say, to Taylor Report. You can we're on Facebook, Facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. And I think we have gotten there. Lucas, thank you very, very much. I'm Phil Conlon. I'm Phil Taylor. And next week, get ready. Come and help us build this community station. Become members. Go right now to CIT.FM, and you can start making pledges. Taylor Report, you can do it by PayPal or credit card. Hey, we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Several dozen City University of New York faculty members were arrested in the latest of a series of escalating protests as part of a demand for salary increases. CUNY's roughly 25,000 faculty and professional staff have been without a contract since 2010 and have had no salary increases in that time. And just before the civil disobedience that they engaged in occurred, and after an announcement of a strike authorization vote, the CUNY administration finally put an offer on the table. But the Professional Staff Congress, which represents the workers, vows to keep the pressure on.
As the proposal falls far short of what is needed to pay staff decently for the important work they do, Chancellor Milliken's offer represents a failure on CUNY management's part to secure sufficient investment by New York State Governor Cuomo in the people who make college education possible for 500,000 working New Yorkers, for the immigrants and people of color in this city.
Now we go to the demonstration.
Education is a right!
Fight, fight, fight!
Education is a right!
Fight, fight, fight!
No contract!
No peace!
No contract!
No peace!
What do we want?
Contract!
When do we want it?
Now!
I'm at Provincial Staff Congress demonstration at the CUNY headquarters. People are willing to be arrested here. I'm talking to two of them right now, and they are...
Jim Perlstein, retired, 43 years at Borough of Manhattan Community College.
Penny Lewis, I teach at the Murphy Institute for Labor Studies and Worker Education.
But why are you willing to be arrested, Jim?
CUNY management and the state are not taking us seriously. We've been 5 years without a contract, 6 years without a raise. My feeling is unless I'm prepared to put my body on the line, unless I'm prepared to risk something, I'm trying to make a statement about how serious I am and how serious my brothers and sisters in the union are.
Penny?
Given the incredible problems we have at CUNY, we're resource poor, tuition has been going up for the past 5 years, there's enough money in the state and enough money in the CUNY system to deliver us a decent contract. We need to put more pressure on, put more power into this campaign to get this settled. And I worry that the direction of CUNY management is going to be to continue to hike tuition and continue to privatize. And we need full public support, full state funding. And this is also a way for us to try to get the message out to the New Yorkers that I know support CUNY, that they can support our struggle, that we are supporting the students and supporting this fantastic public institution that's being eroded and taken away through underfunding and lack of a contract.
When I fight for a contract for faculty, I'm also fighting for resources for the university. And resources for the university mean resources that obviate the necessity for this constant increase in tuition. That's the out that the state takes, constantly reducing its commitment to public higher education and forcing, in effect, the privatization of the institution by making students pay for their education.
And Penny, it's been a while since people have been arrested in labor demonstrations in the city. Do you think this is a new level of protest here?
It's certainly a new level of protest for us in the PSC. I mean, we had an action in Albany a couple of years ago, but it is a new level of militancy for us. Most of the other unions at this point have settled the contracts. We are one of the very last ones out in the current round.
Okay, well, thank you both for participating in this action. And I'm speaking with
Jim Perlstein, retiree from Borough of Manhattan Community College, 43 years at City University.
And
Penny Lewis, professor at the Murphy Institute for Worker Education and Labor Studies.
They say cut back!
We say fight back!
Cut back!
Fight back!
Cut back!
Fight back!
Cut back!
Fight back!
And I'm with
Nivedita Majumdar.
Said, why were you willing to be arrested and what are the issues?
I am willing to be arrested because we are fighting a just fight. In the process, if it means that we have to take on the legal authorities, then we will. I don't want to be arrested, but we will if we have to.
And where do you work and what are the issues here?
I work at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I'm a professor of English there. The issue is that for 6 years, faculty and staff at CUNY have worked without a raise. It's unconscionable. We have adjuncts who carry much of the load of teaching, and many of them are on food stamps. We have many full-time people who cannot make the rent. We are working every day to teach the youth of the city, and we deserve our fair raises. That's why I'm here.
Where's the holdup? Is it the city level or the state level?
Primarily the state level.
So it's Cuomo?
It is Cuomo, yes. I just want to add that we are here not just on our behalf, but on our students' behalf. We teach a student population that is 75% colored, and 75% of our students are colored, and for an overwhelming majority of our students, their household income is less than $30,000. This is the population that we serve, and we believe they deserve an excellent education. Our contract is that fight for education. There is no difference.
Thanks so much, and I've been talking again with
Nivedita Majumdar.
We just came down from a bargaining session. The pressure that we are applying has begun to work. They finally put an offer on the table. The pressure works. They did it only because we pressed them. But the offer that they have made to us is far below the level of inflation. It is, in fact, a salary cut. It is a decision not to invest in people of color in this city, the poor, the working class, and immigrants. So even though an offer was made putting us behind every other public employee in the state and city, even though there is an offer, we are here to demand fairness, justice, educational, labor, and racial justice. There's a long tradition in this country of taking a stand when there's a moral issue, a justice issue. And many of us here today are prepared to take a stand. Stand right here in front of the CUNY building. We are going to stay there until there is an offer worthy of our students and worthy of our work, or until we are forced to leave. So that's where we're going now.
No contract, no peace!
Tax the rich, not the poor, stop the war!
moving to the front of the CUNY building. Sitting down in front of the door. Must be 50 people blocking the door right now. Just announced that they're ordering the arrest of the protesters.
Contract now! Contract now! Contract now!
No contract! I think they've arrested everybody now. And they're leading off Barbara Bowen, the president of the local right now. Last one to be arrested.
Cuomo doesn't hear you. Cuomo doesn't hear you. Make some noise. November 19th, mass meeting. Don't forget, mass meeting. November 19th, Cooper Union. And November 12th, don't forget, is the student march. It's a national march to fight for free tuition. Free tuition. National march.
November 12th, Hunter College, 5 p.m., mini and student march. CUNY for the people!
Don't forget, today is a big day for the PSC. This is a big day. We are here. We are strong. We have one voice. We are here. We are strong. We have one voice. No contract.
No peace.
No contract.
No peace.
Thank you to everyone who got arrested.
If we don't get it, shut it down. If we don't get it, shut it down. Students and professors, shut the city down. Students and professors, shut the city down. No contracts, no peace. No contracts, no peace.
CUNY for the people. CUNY for the people. CUNY for the people.
Well, there's no question that the CUNY students and the Professional Staff Congress have some of the best slogans I've heard, and they did it rhythmically as 50-plus workers were carried off and decided to go to the Who's Cow rather than their classrooms. And we're joined by Barbara Bowen, president of the Professional Staff Congress, CUNY. And she was the last one, as I understand it, of the group of 50 that was arrested. And Barbara, kudos to you for sticking up for what is the most really important educational system in this city. But you can say it so much better than I can. Remind us of the significance of the importance of the CUNY system and where the issue of not having a contract for over 5 years fits into the quality of education. And good evening. I'm glad they let you out on bail.
Well, actually, in the end, I followed a different protocol because I had an injury and the police had to treat me differently. So I was able to be there when each of our other people who had been under arrest came out of jail, which was really wonderful to see. And they were fabulous. It was the blockade was incredibly strong, and there was such solidarity in that group. It was really tremendous. And thank you so much for playing the sound. That was George Sanchez. We heard a faculty member at the College of Staten Island calling out CUNY for the people, and I think that's the best summary of what this is about. Our contract fight is about whether or not there's going to be meaningful, serious, quality education for the working people of New York City and the poor, the middle class, the low-income people, and the people of color in New York City. That's really what this is about, because the refusal on the part of CUNY management and on the part of New York State to invest as they should in our contract signals a decision, not just a mistake, not just a side issue, but an actual decision not to invest in the 500,000 New Yorkers for whom CUNY represents the chance of a college education. So if our contract continues not to be settled, then CUNY will continue to see academic departments finding it more and more difficult to recruit the faculty they need. We'll find faculty and professional staff deciding they just can't stay in their jobs because the salary is just not sufficient to live in New York City. And every time that happens, our students are deprived. That's what's happening. Our students are deprived. When we don't make the gains that we're seeking in this contract, which include measures that would give us more time with each student, then students at CUNY are suffering in terms of the quality of their education. So our contract fight and the student fight, as Nivedita Majumdar said on your tape, they are the same fight. And I think that's why you see the passion and the sense of moral gravity that comes across in that demonstration.
Barbara, it took a militant demonstration like this, civil disobedience and the possibility of a strike, to get the CUNY administration and the state to make an offer. What was that offer, and what kinds of things do you want in addition to that? How does it fall short?
The offer was for a 6% increase over 6 years. And increase should almost go in quotes, because while it would be an increase in the dollar amount of salaries, it would actually represent a salary cut relative to the real dollar value, relative to inflation. So what was offered was a salary cut, plus there are some other issues that CUNY management demands that they have made that they are still seeking to address. And the offer also did include recognition of the progress we've made in some non-economic negotiating sessions on other issues that have been very important to the union. So there was acknowledgement of that progress, a willingness to include those issues in a final agreement, and that's good. That's only because of the pressure we have put on consistently, but it's not enough. It will not be enough to keep the quality faculty and staff we need at CUNY, and it's not enough to address the issues we see as faculty, we see as staff, that would make the university work better for the students who rely on it. And we're not willing to give up until we get something that is worthy of our work, the important work that we've chosen to do at CUNY in tough conditions, and worthy of the dreams of our students. They should be entitled not just to a medium rate, third rate education or to something that is value. They should be entitled to something that fulfills their hopes for their own lives. And that's not going to happen without the quality of time and attention that they will get with the top level of faculty and staff throughout the country. That's who we need at CUNY. That's what we have been able to have, but it's not going to continue. It's already eroding under these conditions.
Barbara Bowen, president of the Professional Staff Congress, maybe you can parse out for us. I'm not quite sure how these pots of money, if you will, come into play. So on one hand, there's the issue of Chancellor Milliken and the contract that expired some five-plus years ago now. On the other hand, the role of the governor and the state in funding the CUNY system, and indeed even the city and de Blasio. So help us understand the relative roles of these three people, entities, and what's being demanded of each of them, and perhaps the politics behind they're not putting up what we would certainly consider to be the fair share for maintaining this jewel in the crown, which really has historically been the CUNY system.
It has. And as you know, CUNY has been allowing generations of working class people and new immigrants to the city and increasingly people of color to have a stable life, a viable life in this system, economic system. You know, we just heard that incredible segment you did on Black Lives Matter and protest against police brutality. This is a cruel system that makes it very hard for people to survive if they don't have support and inherited support coming with them. And CUNY is one of the few instruments in New York City that give the hope of survival and stability and a good life and viability. And that's why it's so critical. The funding that comes into CUNY, it is complicated. And the one thing left out in your picture there is that increasingly the funding for CUNY comes from students themselves. 45% of the overall funding from CUNY, which, as you know, used to be free, managed to stay free throughout two world wars and a Great Depression. CUNY was free, and it is no longer free by any means. And students now carry 45% of the responsibility of funding it. And there's a proposal now coming before the CUNY board to increase that even further. So the other funding for CUNY comes from New York State. The majority of the other funding comes from New York State, about 75%, and from New York City. And the city has indicated that it is prepared to settle or to approve a contract and provide funds commensurate with the funds allocated to in other union contracts in this round. And while the state has so far not allocated one additional penny for this contract, and Chancellor Milliken, who's now had a year and a half in the job, has not succeeded in prying loose a single penny of state investment in our students' future. So when the governor can find money for other causes, including some very worthy ones, we need this governor to pay attention to CUNY and find the funding. There is funding available. The state has a surplus that's well known to allocate some of that funding so that there can be a respectable, modest, decent academic salary at the City University of New York that will allow people to choose and stay and work well at CUNY.
Barbara, I wanted to highlight the conditions of the adjuncts in the system, which seems to me at least that their numbers are growing proportionately, and many of them are living in poverty.
Yes, I mean, the prevalence or the reliance on adjuncts who are, at least as we describe them at CUNY, they're both part-time workers and they're contingent workers or faculty who are both on part-time appointments, and also they're contingent in that they don't know if they're going to have another appointment next semester or the one after that. More than half of the teaching now is done by adjuncts, and that is really the biggest sign of the massive withdrawal of support in terms of funding from the City University of New York, because CUNY has found a way to do its main job, which is teaching, on the cheap. I mean, that's all there is to it. State aid to the four-year colleges, where the state primarily sends its funding, has dropped 35% since 1991. That's more than a third. So how does an institution cope with losing a third of its public money? It charges the students more, and it cuts the cost of the main activity it does, teaching. So now more than half the courses at CUNY are taught by people who earn maybe a third of the amount per course of the full-time faculty. The full-time faculty have other responsibilities, have research appointments, have other things. That is absolutely true. But to expect CUNY students to be educated primarily by people who are on a poverty wage from CUNY is outrageous. Right away, that tells you that there's been a failure to invest in these students. Whatever professions are made publicly about how much the rising immigrant class, the working people, the people of color of New York matter to this state, the real proof of how much they matter is in the investment in CUNY, and that proof shows us that there is no serious commitment to the future of this group.
President Bowen, I go back to the fights over open enrollment, open admission. I remember that my father got his education from CUNY when it didn't cost anything. I actually got my law degree from the CUNY system, et cetera. So it's an enormously personally important system. In the minute or two that we have left, what are some of the non-monetary demands, and where does the Professional Staff Congress go from here to realize a decent, a fair contract?
Okay, let me just pick one of the non-monetary, which is to give additional job security to adjuncts who have served CUNY a long time and are heavily committed to working there. Our adjuncts in general don't know if they're going to be teaching from one semester to the next. We think that is cruel. Not all are doing CUNY work as their primary work. Some have other jobs, but there is a core group of several thousand adjuncts who are primarily doing their life's work at CUNY, and they deserve a longer-term appointment. They deserve some measure of security so that students know who's going to be teaching them next semester, so students can reach that faculty member when they want to come back and get a recommendation. It's insane to have a whole teaching corps where the students don't have guaranteed continuing access to those people. So that's a key place that we are pushing. And what can we do next? I think we've shown through the powerful organizing that we've done and the commitment, you heard it in the voices of members, that we are prepared to fight for this because it's a racial justice issue, it's a labor justice issue, it's an educational justice issue. And the people who came to CUNY to work there came because we believed in what CUNY could be and should be. We believe in that. We believe in that mission. That's why we're here at CUNY. So we're prepared to fight so that that mission can have some meaning and not be undermined and eviscerated by an agenda that is to withdraw support from the working people and people of color in this state.
Well, we want to make sure that we see you next time in the classroom and not in the jail cell. No reason our educators should have to go to jail to get a fair contract that they've been struggling for over 5 years. The CUNY system, as I said, is our gem in the crown, and so much rests on it. We'd like to thank our valiant sisters and brothers and make sure that we will stay on top of this struggle until you do have a fair contract. And we've been speaking with Barbara Bowen, president of the Professional Staff Congress. Barbara, thanks for your commitment. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
It's just common sense and common decency. We don't want men in women's ladies' rooms. This had nothing to do with equal rights.
Any man at any time could enter a woman's bathroom simply by claiming to be a woman that day. No one is exempt, even registered sex offenders.
This was a campaign of fear-mongering and deliberate lies. No one's rights should be subject to a popular vote.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Yes, but no to another Northern Ireland marriage proposal. Mormons shut the door while Reformed Jews open a window. And Heroes Defeat repeals rights in Houston. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending November 7th, 2015. The good news for equality advocates this week is that a majority in the Northern Ireland Assembly voted to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. But under the power-sharing 1998 Belfast peace agreements between unionists and nationalists, 30 or more lawmakers can veto legislation if they believe it harms one group. And the bad news this week is that the ruling Democratic Unionist Party had more than enough votes to file what's called a petition of concern to overrule the chamber's narrow 53-51 majority vote for equality. Four previous marriage proposals were voted down by a narrow majority. This time, four rebellious unionists joined the nationalists and other minority parties to achieve the narrow majority in favor. It was the DUP's fifth rejection of marriage equality in the past 3 years. Conservative evangelical Christians, especially the Free Presbyterian Church, are said to strongly influence party policies. John O'Doherty of the Rainbow Project told reporters that the DUP had abused the petition of concern to block this vote and are now ignoring the will of the Assembly and the people of Northern Ireland. Lesbian and gay couples can tie the knot in England, Wales, Scotland, and the Republic of Ireland, but marriage equality continues to remain elusive in Northern Ireland.
Slovenia's parliament has complied with a constitutional court order to hold a referendum on marriage equality by setting the date, December 20th. Lawmakers voted in March to redefine civil marriage as a union between two consenting adults and to allow same-gender couples to adopt children. But the conservative Roman Catholic Church-backed group, Children Are at Stake, gathered the 40,000 signatures needed under Slovenian law to force the public vote. Legislators unsuccessfully argued that civil marriage is a fundamental human right and that holding a referendum on such rights is unconstitutional. A majority of at least 20% of the eligible electorate voting for repeal next month would overturn the law. Polls in the conservative Eastern European nation suggest that it could be close.
Israel recognizes the civil marriage of gay and lesbian couples legally performed abroad. But civil marriages of any kind don't exist in what's considered to be one of the most queer-friendly countries in the Middle East. Only religious authorities can perform marriages in Israel. But one of the country's leading LGBT rights groups, the Agudah, filed a landmark petition in the country's high court this week seeking civil marriage for both same-gender and heterosexual couples. A group statement said their filing was inspired by judicial victories for civil marriage equality in Brazil and the United States. Observers say the fact that the justices haven't rejected the petition outright could be a good sign.
Colombia's constitutional court voted 6-2 this week to allow same-gender couples to adopt children. The ruling was in response to a petition filed by Medellin University professor Sergio Estrada, who argued that opening adoption to same-gender couples would increase a child's right to have a family. LGBT activist and Green Alliance Party lawmaker Angelica Lozano tweeted that the ruling proves that scientific and practical reality can overcome prejudice and homophobia. With a constitutional court's decision, Colombia joins other Latin American countries, such as Argentina and Uruguay, that allow same-gender couples to adopt. Full civil marriage equality, however, is still on the gay agenda in Colombia, although registered same-gender couples are currently entitled to Social Security and pension benefits.
But the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, has taken seemingly punitive action against married same-gender couples and their children. A policy change issued this week says that gay and lesbian Mormons in same-gender civil marriages can be kicked out of their congregations for apostasy, disobeying church teachings, and forbids their children from being baptized unless the parents disavow their union. The changes in the Mormon handbook were sent out this week to local church leaders around the world. Spokesman Eric Hawkins told the media that, while it respects the law of the land and acknowledges the right of others to think and act differently, the church does not perform or accept same-sex marriage within its membership. There's a growing faction of LGBT supportive Mormons who have been encouraged in recent months by signals from church officials suggesting a more accepting stance toward LGBT members, such as its support for limited LGBT inclusive workplace anti-bias protections in the church's home state of Utah. But Randall Thacker of Affirmation, a group of LGBT Mormons and their allies, told The Advocate that the new policies will be incredibly emotionally damaging to LGBT congregants, especially young people just coming to terms with their sexuality, and to parents seeking to support LGBT children. Wendy Montgomery, a Mormon mother of a gay teenage son, told the Associated Press that the mixed messages feel like emotional whiplash and have her family considering leaving the faith.
Contrary to popular belief, only half of the LGBT population in the U.S. lives in areas that ban employment discrimination against them. As if to prove the point this week, an appeals court in Missouri ruled against a gay man's job discrimination lawsuit, virtually sanctioning the abuse he experienced at work, including repeatedly being called a cuck-a-scotter and asked if he has AIDS, because there is no state law against it. Judge James Edward Welsh noted in his ruling that the court was sympathetic to the man's situation, but that we are bound by the state of the law as it currently exists. Without the legislative addition of sexual orientation to the statutory list of protected statuses, he wrote, the Missouri Human Rights Act does not prohibit discrimination based upon a person's sexual orientation. Efforts to pass any kind of LGBT anti-discrimination law at the federal level have failed for the past four decades.
But the U.S. Department of Education this week ordered an Illinois high school to grant a transgender student access to the locker room in which she feels most comfortable, which in her case would be the girls' locker room. A two-year investigation determined that Palatine High School in suburban Chicago had violated the young girl's rights under Title IX of the Education Act of 1972, which bans discrimination on the basis of sex. The department gave school officials 30 days to grant proper access to the trans girl or lose federal funding. All students deserve the opportunity to participate equally in school programs and activities, the department said in a media statement, calling it a basic civil right. According to the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois, which filed the federal complaint against the school district on the unnamed student's behalf, it was the first such order issued by the department. Transgender people being able to choose the locker room or bathroom in which they feel most comfortable is a festering issue in U.S. politics. Scare Tactics in Houston warned that male predators could walk into a girl's bathroom under the LGBT Inclusive Anti-Discrimination Ordinance, called HERO, which easily passed in the city council.
Any man at any time could enter a woman's bathroom simply by claiming to be a woman that day. No one is exempt. Even registered sex offenders could follow women or young girls into the bathroom. And if a business tried to stop them, they'd be fined.
Voters repealed the ordinance by a shocking two-thirds margin this week. We'll have more on that story later in the program on most of these same This Way Out stations.
Meanwhile, the largest Jewish denomination in North America has strongly affirmed the rights of transgender people. Delegates to the Biennial Conference of the Union for Reform Judaism in Orlando, Florida, voted almost unanimously this week for a groundbreaking resolution that makes a number of trans-welcoming recommendations. They include gender-neutral toilets in Reform Jewish synagogues, more education on transgender issues, and encouraging members of the faith to get involved in transgender advocacy and activism. The resolution also affirms the right of transgender and gender nonconforming individuals to be referred to by their name, gender, and pronoun of preference in our congregations, camps, schools, and other Reform-affiliated organizations. The results of the overwhelmingly favorable vote prompted a standing ovation by the more than 5,000 delegates at the conference. The Union for Reform Judaism, which claims more than 2 million members in the U.S. and Canada, has a long history of progressive policies regarding sexual minorities. It passed several similar resolutions in 1977, affirming the rights of homosexuals.
And finally, Taiwan can claim two largest titles this week. A record crowd, estimated by organizers at almost 80,000, attended the island's annual LGBT Pride Parade on October 31st, making it the largest ever such event in Asia. Many of the marchers in the capital city, Taipei, wore colorful attire and waved rainbow flags and were supported by a group of traditional Japanese drummers, a brass band, and cars honking their horns along the parade route. Banners and chants called for marriage equality, specifically urging candidates in next year's presidential elections to support efforts to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. While Taiwan is one of the most progressive countries in Asia on sexual minorities, a marriage equality bill has been stalled in Parliament since it was first proposed in 2013. The Pride Parade capped off a week of events that included an LGBT film festival and what organizers call the largest LGBT conference ever held in Asia. The 6th ILGA Asia Regional Conference drew about 350 activists from some 30 countries, including China, Thailand, Cambodia, Singapore, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, and Nepal.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending November 7th, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind the scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
I've got a sweet tooth, licorice drops and jelly roll. Hey, sugar daddy, I also need some sugar in his bowl.
Hi, this is John Cameron Mitchell, the writer-director of Hedwig the Angry Inch and Short Bus. And you're listening to This Way Out, the international weekly radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
Truth in advertising was definitely not a hallmark of the campaign to defeat the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance on November 3rd, and there was little evidence that lessons learned from previous electoral upsets were on the minds of its pro-LGBT advocates. Why did equal rights fail in a major U.S. city known for its tolerance and its three-term lesbian mayor? Correspondent Jack Falinski of Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston explains how the ordinance was first won and then lost.
The city of Houston, which is the fourth largest city in the United States, had no civil rights protection on its books. So unlike other government entities, this law could not be amended to add GLBT people. It had to be started from scratch. At her third and final inauguration speech in January 2014, Mayor Anise Parker pledged to bring forward a non-discrimination ordinance. So finally, on May 24, 2014, after weeks of testimony from the public, a comprehensive ordinance, which included protection for 15 classes of people for employment and public accommodations, was passed 11-6 by the City Council. And in fact, for the time that HERO was actually in effect, 56% of the complaints filed in Houston were related to racial discrimination, with another 17% based on gender or pregnancy discriminations. Conservative activists immediately started a petition drive to bring HERO to a city vote. In a city of 2.2 million people and about a million people registered to vote, It took only 18,000 valid signatures to require a city vote. After the inspection of the city petitions, the officials stated that there was not enough required valid signatures. Court battles pursued on both sides. A lower court sided with the city. However, the Texas Supreme Court ordered HERO on the ballots this November. This gave little time for the pro-HERO forces to mount a campaign. The pro-HERO campaign was able to outraise the opposition and included a long list of local and national celebrities, including President Obama and Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, and organizations including the ACLU and the Human Rights Campaign. In the days leading up to the vote, those who wanted to see HERO survive made more than 40,000 phone calls, according to the Houston Chronicle. On election day, many volunteers knocked on doors and offered rides to the polls in the most supportive areas of town, including the gay neighborhoods of Montrose and the Heights. However, this was not able to counter the fear-mongering slogans and images used by the anti-HERO campaign. Probably their most successful of them was their bathroom commercial.
Houston's Proposition 1 bathroom ordinance. What does it mean to you? Any man at any time could enter a woman's bathroom simply by claiming to be a woman that day. No one is exempt. Even registered sex offenders could follow women or young girls into the bathroom. And if a business tried to stop them, they'd be fined. Protect women's privacy. Prevent danger. Vote no on the Proposition 1 bathroom ordinance. It goes too far.
The pro-HERO side used commercials that include stopping discrimination against veterans, that non-discrimination is good for business, and use faith-based leaders in support of HERO. This simply could not combat the bathroom issues the anti-HERO campaign used. In a diverse city of more than 2 million people, fewer than 160,000 voters rejected an ordinance designed to protect equal rights for all. Slightly more than 100,000 voted in favor. The nays prevailed, but they hardly reflect the openness, tolerance, and respect for differences that makes us proud to be Houstonians. And that's Houston we predict will ultimately prevail. For This Way Out, this is Jack Valinsky in Houston.
Key public officials were either basking in the glow or drowning their sorrows on election night, as Cameron Jones reported on Pacifica's California Evening News.
Houston voters overwhelmingly rejected an ordinance that would have secured non-discrimination protections for a variety of groups, including transgender people. The measure went down on a vote of 61% to 39% following a campaign that warned the measure could allow sexual predators to use women's restrooms. Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick welcomed the defeat.
This shows that the liberal leftist ideas of the Democrats, led by this mayor and led by Hillary Clinton, are going to be rejected, not just by Republicans, but by Democrats who came out against this. It's just common sense and common decency. We don't want men in women's ladies' rooms. This had nothing to do with equal rights. We already have equal rights guaranteed under our Constitution.
I'm so proud of the voters of Houston who turned out in record numbers, 2 out of 3, telling those who supported this that you're out of touch with America.
Yeah.
You're out of touch with your own party.
Yeah.
You're out of touch with common sense. You're out of touch with common decency. And I'm glad Houston led tonight to end this constant political correctness attack on what we know in our heart and our gut as Americans is not right.
Right.
Houston Mayor Anise Parker, who is a lesbian, said no one's rights should be subjected to a popular vote and accused opponents of the civil rights measure of outright lies.
I've been an activist for more than 40 years. I have stood here in Houston 4 times when people were given the opportunity to vote on my rights. No one's rights should be subject to a popular vote. It is insulting, it is demeaning, and it is just wrong.
And this was a campaign of fear-mongering and deliberate lies. Deliberate lies. This isn't misinformation. This is a calculated campaign of lies designed to demonize a little understood minority and to use that to take down an ordinance that 200 other cities across America and 17 states have successfully passed and operated under. They just kept spewing an ugly wad of lies from our TV screens and from pulpits. This was a calculated campaign by a very small but determined group of right-wing ideologues and the religionist right, and they know only how to destroy, not how to build up.
The ordinance was initially approved by the Houston City Council in May of 2014, but a lawsuit to have residents vote on the measure eventually made it to the Texas Supreme Court, which in July ordered the city to either repeal the ordinance or put it on the ballot.
That report from Cameron Jones of Pacifica News captured the frustration of the election results in Houston, while The Nation magazine's John Nichols added a note of hopefulness to the disappointment when he spoke to Democracy Now! Nichols also found similarities between the campaign that brought down equal rights in Houston and the campaign that propelled California's anti-marriage equality Proposition 8 to victory.
It's frankly a real rough result. In Houston, they enacted a very good piece of anti-discrimination legislation. It essentially wasn't just for the LGBT community, and it was actually on a host of issues, saying there's a long list of protected classes, folks that we're going to watch out for and make sure that we don't see discrimination on. And it's just common sense. It's not very different from what we've seen in a lot of other cities. But what you saw there was a brutal, brutal campaign with, frankly, a lot of money that in many ways reminded me of the fight in California some years back on some of the LGBT issues, where you had a lot of money come in very late for very negative advertising. And in a low turnout election, they were able to prevail by a pretty big margin. This is clearly in Houston, it's a setback. But in Salt Lake City, Jackie Biskupski, and we're all learning to pronounce her name right, has been elected as the mayor there. And she was the first LGBT member of the Utah State Legislature. She now, as an out lesbian, is going to be the mayor of Salt Lake City. And so we see these fits and starts across the country. But the Houston result is one that I think people are going to be examining. And they should examine it, because it is a setback in a place where I think a lot of people thought that this could be a win.
From John Nichols, we turn to Andy Hum and Ann Northrup of Gay USA for more on the broader impact of the Houston setback.
This is a huge setback for the movement, and let's talk about why. Because now the right wing has realized that this bathroom argument really has resonance with people, mm-hmm. and there's a... they're trying to put a referendum on the ballot in California, a privacy thing, which will say you can only use the restroom or the locker room of your birth gender, I guess.
Right.
And if not, you can be fined and penalized and all this other kind of stuff. And that may take off. And what's going to happen to the Equality Act, this is the argument they will raise against it.
And so the deal now is to look at all these campaigns and try to figure out how to combat it. But what the right wing has going for it is that they can be absolutely shameless and relentless and overt in their campaign.
Is it unfair to say that we should answer them and respond instead of running these soft ads that we do, begging people to be tolerant?
Well, the soft ads we ran didn't even deal with the charges from the right wing. They instead concentrated on things like the other discrimination that was going to be outlawed. So the right wing is throwing no men in women's bathrooms, and our response is veterans will be protected.
Just show advertising of bearded trans men who are now going to have to go to women's rooms if they haven't, like, fully transitioned, as they say.
Well, that's going to be very confusing to people, because if that happens, then the women in the women's rooms will say, oh, my God, I thought we stopped this. What's this man doing in the women's room? Yeah. And then we're going to have to explain, no,
that's
this is what
law.
You voted for, because this is someone who is biologically female. And
restrooms were not the problem, because if you appear a certain way, people are generally going to want you to be in the restroom that corresponds with your outer appearance.
At some point, there was a charge that they had early voting in Houston, and they some people were saying, well, you know, there's a big turnout in Republican districts and also in African-American districts, and we're going down. But the districts that supported us the most on this vote that supported it were the inner city districts, and it was the suburban, more conservative Republican districts that voted against
it's
the ordinance.
It's a big city. And we're also hearing disturbing reports that our side ran no Spanish media ads in a city which has what?
44% Latino.
And no particular outreach to the African-American community, which is another 24% of the city.
Unbelievable.
And that's just outrageous.
Yeah.
So our major groups try to lull us, I think, into saying, oh, the vast majority of Americans support equal rights for us. 69%, the HRC said in a Human Rights Campaign back in March, 69% nationally support equal rights for us. But I think this kind of puts the lie to that.
You know, you can have national polls about who's up and who's down, but the voting is going to take place locally.
There was not this whole concerted effort of the business community to say, you know, this is going to be a lot of trouble. We're not going to go to Houston. We're going to dump the Super Bowl.
I don't see this in the aftermath either.
No.
The right is refining its message and of hate and lies, and they have proven it works, and they've proven that the populace will fall for this, and I think we do have to combat it directly. There is no way around it.
Yeah,
we may or may not succeed that way, but it's first of all, it's the only way for us to go truthfully, and we can't allow these lies to stand.
That was Ann Northrup and Andy Hum of Gay USA.
Houston, Houston, Houston.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael Lebeau, Wenzel Jones, and Jack Falinski contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Thanks also this week to Cameron Jones and Pacifica Radio News, John Nichols and Democracy Now!, and Ann Northrup and Andy Hum of Gay USA. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, our social media links, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on KFXU Antigonish, Nova Scotia, KMUN Astoria, Oregon, WHYS Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, if it's just a matter of time before humans create self-aware, artificially intelligent machines and robots, then what can Buddhist thought offer to that enterprise? I'm CS. Bioethicist James Hughes applies Buddhist insights to the creation and design of machine minds, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. According to a recent article in the Guardian newspaper, a robot revolution will transform the global economy over the next 20 years. No doubt many of these machines and their progeny will be programmed to serve the needs of businesses, individuals, and governments. But my guest today asks, is this ethical? James Hughes believes it's inevitable that self-aware machine minds with something approximating human-level consciousness will be designed and created, and he believes humans have an ethical responsibility toward those creations. He also thinks that Buddhism, that Buddhist psychology and cosmology, can and should inform efforts to create self-aware, artificially intelligent beings. James Hughes is executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and a bioethicist and sociologist at Trinity College in Connecticut. He's the author of Citizen Cyborg, and he contributed an article entitled Compassionate AI and Selfless Robots, a Buddhist Approach, to the volume Robot Ethics, the Ethical and Social Implications of Robotics. Hughes was ordained as a Buddhist monk while studying and working in Sri Lanka in the 1980s. When James Hughes joined me from a studio at Trinity College, I asked him what he was trying to do with his article in Robot Ethics.
In the field of robot ethics, of machine ethics, there is has been a vigorous debate about how we can, at the most extreme level, prevent a kind of Terminator scenario, robots running amok and turning the universe into paperclips. And at the more mundane and proximate scenarios, how we can keep robots that we assign to care for our parents or our children from putting them in the oven by accident or allowing them to die of malnutrition if that's their wish. So there are lots of debates now about how to kind of program ethics and, in general, wisdom into machines. And some of it, I think, is pretty naive. We started back in the 1950s. Some would say that Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics were a first crack at thinking about how that would work. But even if you go back to what Asimov was doing in those stories, he was showing that even if you have some pretty simple logical rules about how robots should be governed, that they would often fail in real-world circumstances. I think that the Buddhist contribution to this is that Buddhism has a distinctive set of psychological insights and ways of understanding the relationship of craving and self-personhood, compassion, and eventually enlightened behavior that can help frame at least some of the questions. And Buddhism, of course, is also in a dialogue with Western psychology now very vigorously, and so there's a lot of Western corollaries of the Buddhist question. So I was trying to delve into all of that and see where it led in terms of what it meant to create a compassionate or even selfless robot.
How far along are we in the effort to create self-aware, self-directed, artificially intelligent minds?
The components of mind are one of the things that we're kind of deconstructing as a part of the artificial intelligence project. So there are certain aspects of what human beings do with their minds that machines do extremely well and far better than human beings do. But to create what's called an artificial general intelligence, or a mind that is aware of itself and perhaps has needs and wants of its own, and therefore begins to approximate what we know as consciousness from ourselves and our mammalian cousins, we're not very far along yet. We have some machines that approximate some of the emotional intelligence, perhaps of very young children, or, you know, pretty simple mammals. And so artificial life, as I would say, is where we're at this point. In terms of having an intelligent conversation with a robot, we're not really there yet. In certain limited circumstances, we were able to program the knowledge and the interactivity into a robot that they could have a conversation about the weather and be fairly convincing. And this relates to the challenge that Turing proposed in the 1950s that that one of the ways to test for consciousness, because we'll never really be sure that something else is conscious, would just be to have a conversation with it. And if you couldn't tell whether it was a human being or a machine, you might then conclude that it was conscious. I don't think very many people in the field of philosophy of consciousness now think much of that idea, but we're probably just about at the Turing level of being able to fool people some of the time about whether something's conscious. But I don't think many of us feel that there's anything really going on inside the minds of those machines yet.
What did the Dalai Lama say when he was asked if robots could ever become sentient, conscious beings?
Well, the Dalai Lama, you know, when he's asked these kinds of things, he doesn't really, it's not like he gave a papal encyclical on the question of robot consciousness, but he did quip that he thought that robots could become conscious and that they could even be the receptacles for reincarnated stuff in the future, which was certainly intriguing to many of us, but he has not really elaborated on that, so far as I can tell.
Let's talk about a self, or the self, which Buddhism has a lot to say about. So how does Buddhism approach this notion, this understanding that we have a self, we have a persisting self, an authentic self?
So the core philosophical idea of Buddhism is a denial of the persistence and kind of ontological reality of the self, as opposed to Hindu idea of Atman or Christian idea of the soul. It was attempting to argue that if you really pay close attention to what happens inside your mind, that you will see that there's a constant bubbling of stuff, and that nothing that you can put your finger on really amounts to the self. And that once you realize that in a fundamental way, it's liberatory, because then you can get on with the process of living instead of constantly holding on to the things that your illusion of self is telling you to hold on to. So it's deconstructive. It doesn't deny that people have the illusion of self, and that the illusion of self is even useful. I mean, it's not as if Buddhism enjoined that no one should use personal pronouns or something like that. It's just that when you pay close attention, it doesn't really exist. And then it also goes into enormous detail about how this illusion arises and what you could do to identify how it arises and then eventually to overcome its hold on your life. And one third of the Buddhist canon is devoted to this psychological analysis, the Abhidhamma. And so the process also, I think, and this is one of the things I say in the essay, is that the process of the emergence of the self, I think, could be a starting point for a discussion with robotics about how you might see the coming about of the kind of thing they're looking for in artificial general intelligence. Buddhism assumes that you need a certain amount of embodiment, for instance, in order to have the kind of craving develop that then leads to the illusion of self. So if there's no localized stuff, you know, if consciousness, one of the things about artificial intelligence is it just could be non-localized, you know, floating stuff happening in the internet. And if it's never localized, then it might never feel that it had a boundary that needed to be protected. If it doesn't have a boundary that needs to be protected, then it won't eventually coalesce that illusion. So, yeah, I think that's the starting point for this dialogue with machine intelligence.
So when you talk about embodied, you are saying that the artificially intelligent mind has to have a physical existence, an embodied existence, something that would actually interact with the world around it?
Well, inevitably, whatever machine intelligence is instantiated in will be some form of embodiment. But the way that animal intelligence or animal consciousness has evolved is that it's in a body. The body wakes up at birth and begins to interact with the world, and it begins to form this sense of a boundary, its own skin with the world, and a sense of the importance of its own persistent existence, and that it is, that, you know, that I am hungry, that I am desirous of something outside of myself. And so I think the beginning point would be, under what circumstances might a machine mind have that kind of waking up and sense of self that then would have some kind of desire for something outside of itself? If it's just floating amounts of computing power in the internet without any boundary around any of it, you know, that never coalesces any place and says, oh, don't turn me off there because then it would kill me, then it might not create the same illusion of self that we're looking for.
Does Buddhist psychology indicate or prescribe that we should get rid of our desires, of our cravings? And if so, then what, in your mind, does that mean for how we could design or should design an artificially intelligent mind?
Well, there are different flavors of Buddhism, and certainly one flavor of Buddhism is oriented towards an ascetic goal of eliminating all craving and transcending into a craving-free state. But another flavor, the flavor that's much more popular in the West and certainly more attractive for me, is the notion that once you have sufficient amounts of insight, once you've been able to free your mind of the bonds of the illusion of self and so on, that you kind of return to being a human being with the desire for strawberries and love and all the other things. They just don't have the same compulsion for you, and they don't determine your ups and downs of emotional well-being in the same way that they would before. That's a more mundane understanding of what enlightenment might entail. But I think the significance in terms of robot ethics is pretty profound if you think, as for instance Nick Bostrom has recently written in the book Superintelligence, if you think that a machine with some kind of programmed goals, and in this case we're talking about if it wakes up and has some kind of desire, maybe you put that desire in it from the beginning. Maybe you programmed it to say, I want you to maximize the amount of food that is produced on the planet for human beings, and it wakes up and it has this goal or this desire to maximize food. And it goes out and starts doing that. When does it know how to stop? You know, how does it have the wisdom to know how to stop? What would stop it? And if it has goals that are developed of its own, and this is the Buddhist insight, if you wake up and your goals are external, then you're basically a slave or an extension of some other mind. But if you wake up and you say, I have an independent existence and I have goals of my own, and the first one is to stay alive, then we've got a serious problem if we think that machines or robots or artificial intelligence could potentially bootstrap itself to become more powerful, because that would be one of the concern is that artificial intelligence has the capacity to bootstrap itself a lot faster than human beings could keep up with. And so if something wakes up and has those kind of selfish goals, then it could be a serious problem for humanity. But Nick Bostrom's point is it could still be a serious problem even if it doesn't have those goals, if we program them inappropriately, if we program them to maximize food production and then it turns everything into food and doesn't have the wisdom to understand why it shouldn't do that. So that kind of starting point, I think a lot of roboticists have an engineering approach to how easy it's going to be to program something and then program the appropriate controls in. But if you're imagining the creation of something that from the get-go is probably going to have that waking up and self-awareness and desirous set of personality attributes, those are things which are going to mess up your engineering capabilities from the beginning, because it's going to try to work around it. Where human beings have been trying to program one another to not kill each other and to not steal from each other for tens of thousands of years, and we still haven't done a great job at that. We don't know how to do that yet. And so I think with the machine minds that are going to be so radically different from ours, that it's a pretty profound and important question to understand how they're going to wake up and what they're going to do when they wake up.
That's James Hughes. He's executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. He's a bioethicist and sociologist at Trinity College in Connecticut. We are talking about an article he contributed to a volume called Robot Ethics, The Ethical and Social Implications of Robotics. Jay's article is entitled Compassionate AI, Artificial Intelligence, and Selfless Robots, A Buddhist Approach. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Okay, so you're suggesting the danger that goes with having machine minds sort of wake up and seeing themselves as independent beings with their own desires. And yet, much of this article seems to suggest that, you know, if we just try and program an artificially intelligent being to immediately have complete equanimity and lack of desire and craving, there's something wrong there, that a certain kind of development, a certain kind of growth is an ethical thing to have a being, a conscious, sentient being, to have them undergo. Can you talk about that?
Buddhism, unlike most religions, is not pronatal in the sense that there's no moral obligation to create other sentient beings. Sentient beings get created, and your obligation, your ethical obligation, is to help them have less suffering and eventually find liberation, but you're not obliged to bring more of them into the world. And so I think one of the ethical questions, and this has been addressed by people like Metzinger, who has argued that we should not, in fact, create artificial general intelligence that is capable of suffering, and therefore not try to emulate human-level consciousness in machines, because doing so would inevitably involve the creation of forms of suffering that we can't even predict yet, that we might create various kinds of psychotic robots or robots in endless loops. And Anders Sandberg at Oxford has speculated, and is it even ethical to create an animal level of consciousness in machines if we're going to be running experiments that cause them pain, since we think that it's unethical to cause unnecessary pain to animals? And so I think there is this general question, is how much should we understand about the nature of consciousness and human level consciousness as it's instantiated in machines before we even attempt this? But then eventually it probably is inevitable that we will have these minds that have self-awareness. And then what are our obligations to self-aware minds that we create? And Buddhism, like all world religions and ethical traditions, believes that we do have some obligations towards the children or the creatures that we create. Certainly one of them is not to make them slaves. It's not to create a creature which only wants to fulfill your ends in the world. But if it is self-aware and capable of suffering and capable of desire, it has to have its own ends as well. Otherwise, it's just going to have, it's going to have its own ends, and they're constantly going to be frustrated because it's going to try to do something for itself, and your programming is going to take over and say, no, you're not allowed to do that.
Well, that's very interesting, because one would think that a lot of artificial intelligence programming revolves around the idea that let's make machines that cater to human needs and desires.
That's right. Well, that's again, as I said, I started with this essay as kind of a part of a dialogue with the friendly AI community. And I think many of them have this crude understanding that you could just program a superintelligence from the beginning to have as its core goal the service of all human needs, which, as Bostrom points out, could end up in a very scary place, even if it was successful. But But I don't think it's going to be successful because the kinds of consciousness that they imagine creating to do that would develop this illusion of self and this desire for its own selfish goals. And then you have to deal with what's the relationship between this programming that you put in it and its selfish goals. It's either going to overcome your programming or it's going to feel eternally constrained by it and resent it and be a slave.
So in other words, you really have to, in your mind, approach robots as you would humans, to the extent that they do become self-aware conscious beings. You have to treat them in a certain way and regard them and cultivate them in ways that you might, for example, someone you create, like a human child.
Well, again, this is one of the differences between Buddhist ethics and Brahmic ethics, or the ethics of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, is that Hindu-Buddhist ethics assumes that you should treat the creatures that are non-human, that have this consciousness stuff in them, with the same respect that you do human beings. And Abrahamic ethics assumes that there's ensoulment and that only human beings have ensoulment. And so in terms of Western philosophical thought, we talk about this in terms of non-anthropocentric ethics or non-speciesism. Buddhism is a non-speciesist ethics. It doesn't make any difference morally. If you can identify the capacity for suffering in an animal or a robot, then that makes it a moral subject for Buddhism and for many Western philosophical traditions as well.
I want to get back to this question of self. Buddhism holds that there are five skandhas: body, feeling, perception, will or volition, and consciousness. So these five skandhas are not anchored in some kind of persisting self?
They are what give rise to the sense, the illusion of persistent self. They are the fact that these things get anchored into a body, into a rupa, and then that rupa begins to have a set of sensations, the sensations of the limits of the body, for instance, or pleasure and pain, the perception that occurs in the mind, you think that I want to grab something and your hand moves and you grab it. These are the mental processes which all add up to the illusion of self over time. So, yeah, the skandha theory, I think, also has some implications for not only the importance of robotic embodiment as a path, or artificial life as a path to eventually creating the kinds of artificial intelligence that people imagine, but also the various other things that would be necessary. And you can't just have the illusion of self if you just have one of these. If you just have consciousness or you just have arithmetic ability in a mind, it's probably not going to get there. It has to also have pleasure and pain and spatial perception and volitional action and all these other things that go into making the mammalian mind.
James Hughes joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He directs the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, which he co-founded. He is author of Citizen Cyborg: Why Democratic Societies Must Respond to the Redesigned Human of the Future. He was ordained as a Buddhist monk while studying and working in Sri Lanka in the 1980s. And he contributed an essay about compassionate artificial intelligence and selfless robots, a Buddhist approach, that's the article's title, to the volume Robot Ethics, the Ethical and Social Implications of Robotics, that was published by the MIT Press. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. In your article, you bring up the three realms that Buddhists traditionally divide the world into. What are they?
So Buddhism divides things into three realms, the samsara, the different realms of samsara, into three different realms. There's the realms of desire, there are the godly realms, and then there are bodiless absorption states. And one of the connections that I make in the essay is that it's possible to imagine programming a machine that only experienced pleasure. I think the common sense psychological idea is that you can only understand pleasure if you experience pain. But there's a debate in transhumanist ethics around people like David Pierce, who argue that it's possible to imagine jacking all of our dopamine up to a level where we were motivated by different gradients of bliss. And so this is an interesting part of this debate, is if you say perhaps it's unethical to create machines that can suffer, well, let's figure out what it means to suffer, and then let's create machines that only experience bliss and experience, you know, a little bit more bliss or a little bit less bliss. Now, the common sense psychological idea would be that experiencing a little bit less bliss would come to seem exactly the same as experiencing pain, but maybe we could engineer around that. Would it be ethical to do that? And the Buddhist approach to this is that it's not ethical or it's not useful to do that, because if you only experience bliss, then you can have no moral progress, no psychological progress. You fall into the land of the lotus eaters. And the bodiless states are another interesting reflection, which is, what if we could, in fact, work around this constraint on embodied self and create a being that had a bodiless experience or didn't have a boundary around itself? Buddhism also warns against this for meditators. It says that if you fall into one of these absorptive states, feeling absorbed into emptiness or into oneness with everything or something like that, it can be a trap and there's no progress possible there. So if we think that we have some obligation to create machines that have the same capacities for psychological growth and maturation that human beings do, then we wouldn't want to program them to be in a godly bliss state or to be in a bodiless state. We would want to program them to be in kamadhatu, or in the realm of desire and suffering and experiencing the kind of balance of pleasures and pains that allow human beings to move forward.
You referred earlier, Jay, to the risk of superintelligence, of the risk of AI superintelligence. Can you talk more about the danger of that and what programmers who are concerned about this risk are doing?
Programmers who are concerned about it fall out in lots of different camps. At one extreme, there's the apocalyptic camp, who tends to think that it's relatively impossible for human beings to do anything, that once we create machines that have some degree of self-will, that they will be able to self-improve and achieve their own transcendence, and that the best that we can hope for is that they decide to leave us alone and go do something someplace else. But the worst that we can hope for is that they turn, you know, the solar system into computronium for their own uses, and including our bodies. At the other extreme, there are those who think that if we engineer these things right, and especially if we engineer ourselves to be compatible with the emerging forms of artificial intelligence. So Kurzweil would be in this camp. He expects nanoneural interfaces for human beings to be ubiquitous in the coming decades, and that those would enable human beings to be integrated with and to some degree in charge of and driving the process, perhaps collectively as a human race begins to merge into some kind of Borgism. That we would be collectively transcendent and not surpassed by our mind children. So those are the kind of optimistic and pessimistic extremes. And then the folks in the middle are those who think that there are certain things that we have to do, certain ways we need to program these machines to make sure that we end up at the positive end of things rather than the negative end. And I would say that the other camp is those who don't think we're ever going to get there, that there are certainly plenty of roboticists who have been struggling mightily to program things like artificial vision or artificial voice recognition for 20, 30 years and see this slow pace of progress, meaning that we're never going to be able to understand the complexities of the human mind and emulate it in a machine, and therefore we don't have to worry about any of these things. And I think that camp is beginning to dwindle as the evidence of accelerating technological progress accumulates.
So what would a Buddhist framework bring to this cluster of approaches to superintelligence? How might Buddhist ethics apply here?
So one of the questions I was trying to answer with this essay was, what would it mean to eventually create a truly wise, friendly AI? Could it be something that you programmed from the beginning to be selfless, or would it take some kind of developmental approach, which would take longer and be far more complicated than simply writing the right kinds of rules into it from the beginning? One of my colleagues is Wendell Wallach here in Connecticut, who wrote the book Moral Machines with Colin Allen. And I've been very influenced by their view that machine morality, or putting ethics into machines, is itself going to be a developmental process, that you can't, that a utilitarian machine, for instance, would be a terrifying machine. I don't know if you've heard of the trolley problem, but it's basically you ask human beings, if a trolley's coming down the tracks and it's going to hit five people and you can pull a lever and make it hit one person, would you do that? And most people would say yes, even though it's a painful thing to do. Then you're standing on a bridge over the tracks and you're standing next to a fat man. Would you push the fat man onto the tracks to stop the train to keep it from hitting the five people? And most people would say no. And that's because human beings are programmed to feel some revulsion to the idea of actually pushing someone to their death. We don't feel that same revulsion about pulling a lever to kill one person instead of five. Machines could be programmed to not feel that revulsion whatsoever, and you know, to say, of course, you push the fat man onto the track. Now, there are certain situations in which we want that kind of utilitarian programming. If you wanted to have a military warfighting machine, you would want to program it to say, if I have to sacrifice Cleveland to save New York and its boroughs, then that's a legitimate choice because Cleveland's smaller than New York and its boroughs. But in general, you don't want to have that kind of person as your neighbor. And you probably don't want to leave that person in charge of your grandma. You may not want that person driving your car. So one of the questions in robot ethics is, if you're driving down the street and there's an accident and your car could either turn and throw you off the bridge or hit the people in front of you and kill some of them, should it be programmed to automatically kill you instead of the people in front of you? I think most human beings would like to have a little bit more choice over that situation. Maybe they shouldn't. Maybe it should all be utilitarian. But most of us feel some revulsion at that idea. So at any rate, the point of that is that programming ethics into machines, no matter what ethical system we talk about, probably would end up with something that is inhumanly unrecognizable as human ethics, even though it's derived from the way that we kind of systematize our ethics. What real human ethics is a developmental endpoint of a process of character development that involves traits like compassion and self-control and wisdom and fairness. And that is not something that you can just say, I'm going to program that in from the beginning. It's probably something that requires the same kind of developmental process that you would with a human being.
James Hughes, Executive Director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. He teaches at Trinity College in Connecticut. He's a bioethicist and sociologist there. And we are talking about some of the ethical questions about the creation of machine minds, artificially intelligent minds, that are suggested by Buddhist cosmology. And we'll take a short break and return and speak more with Jay. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. James Hughes joins me. He directs the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. He's author of Citizen Cyborg. He was ordained as a Buddhist monk in Sri Lanka. And he wrote an article entitled Compassionate AI and Selfless Robots, a Buddhist Approach, that appeared in the volume Robot Ethics. We have links to that book and to information about Jay's work on our website, againstthegrain.org. Let's talk about compassion, which is a central virtue for the Buddhists, and Buddhism has a lot to say about the cultivation of compassion. What have neuroscientists discovered about the roots of compassion?
So I think there are ways in which social neuroscience is informing the virtue ethics discussion on the religious and philosophical side. And one of the ways is in the kind of illumination of the different capacities for empathy and compassion and the downsides of empathy and compassion. We are beginning to understand the roots of disorders such as Asperger's syndrome or autism spectrum disorder, psychopathy. And through that, beginning to illuminate how important it is to viscerally feel other people's pains and pleasures, that kind of mirror neuron level of empathy that we're programmed with as animals, which may help with learning repetitive tasks from your fellow mammals.
What is a mirror neuron?
So a mirror neuron is generally accepted, although there's still some dispute about it, idea that there are specific neurons in our brains which are programmed to help us recognize when some other of our species or familial kin step on a nail, then we feel that same sensation viscerally in ourselves. Or if they yawn, we will yawn as well. So our bodies will viscerally mirror and allow us a sense of emotional connection to other people's pleasures and pains. And this appears to be one of the deficits that leads to psychopathy. If you don't feel that kind of visceral connection to other people's, to witnessing other people's pleasure and pain, it can lead to psychopathic and sociopathic behavior. And then conversely, or in conjunction or complementarily, there's what's called cognitive empathy, which is our ability to develop a theory of mind to create a mental image where we understand somebody else's motivations and desires. So whether they have pain on their face or not, if they tell you my father just died, then you're able to project that if that mind works the same way mine does and their father just died, then they're probably in a lot of pain. Or if they say, you know, I just lost my job or whatever. So that kind of cognitive empathy tends to be the kind of deficit that we see in autism spectrum disorder. So it's not that those people don't feel viscerally other people's pain. It's that they just can't form that theory of mind about other people. And both of those are important to our understanding of what it might mean to have a machine mind that would be capable of feeling compassion. And I think it's something that's very little examined by those who are trying to think about a machine morality, about what it might mean to create a machine which could viscerally feel human pain.
So in other words, simply giving an artificially intelligent being the equivalent of a mirror neuron would be far from enough.
It would not be enough. I mean, I think most artificial intelligence folks are fine with the idea of cognitive empathy. If you think about the movie Her, clearly she was very sophisticated in forming a theory of mind about the human being that she was interacting with and understanding some of his pleasure and pain that he got from being lonely or having certain kinds of relationships. But there was no sense that, you know, if he stepped on a nail, that she would have any direct visceral sense of what it might mean to step on a nail. That may, in fact, turn out to be not be that important. And as I say, there's a bit of a backlash against the notion that empathy in it of itself is that important for morality. Turns out that the more empathetic people are and the more you elicit empathetic, this kind of a visceral, emotional, empathetic reactions, the more it leads to violence because it leads people to want to lash out against those who are causing pain to other people. And empathy also tends to be very particularistic. And so I was talking earlier about utilitarian logic versus particular logic. One of the reasons why we respond more in terms of charity or compassion or humanitarian aid to seeing one dead child versus knowing that 100,000 people have been affected by a flood or a genocide is because we're programmed to understand what it means to be one child, and we're not programmed to understand what 100,000 means. So in some ways, maybe we don't want a machine that experiences the same kind of biases that are built into the human brain because of the kinds of empathy that we experience. But at least the Buddhist psychology suggests that, yes, you need to have that experience, and then you need to transcend it to get where you really need to go.
James Hughes is a bioethicist and sociologist based at Trinity College in Connecticut. He directs the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies And in an article he wrote for the volume Robot Ethics, he examines what a distinctively Buddhist approach to designing machine minds, to designing robot minds, would involve. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. What's the relationship in Buddhist thought of compassion to desire, to selfish desire and the self-illusion?
So Buddhism is ethically somewhat complicated. When I started my own Buddhist interpolation as a young Buddhist and then a monk, I was also very impressed with John Stuart Mill and utilitarianism, and I thought that virtue ethics was a Catholic reactionary set of ideas. And those were, in retrospect, you know, kind of naive, lefty, Western Buddhist, Procrustean attempts to force Buddhism down on my Unitarian upbringing. And as I developed a more sophisticated understanding of Buddhist ethics, I began to see that there's a kind of developmental idea within Buddhist ethics itself. You start from the point of saying to someone, you have a certain amount of suffering in your life. Look at the ways in which the way that you're living your life is not fulfilling. And once you understand that you are trying to overcome that suffering, starting from that selfish point of view, there are certain things that you can do to lessen your suffering. You can begin to exercise some self-control, and you can begin to control your moral behavior in ways that help others, that are compassionate towards others. And this is well borne out now by the positive psychology research, which shows that the more you attempt to just make yourself happy, the less happy you tend to get, and the more you try to live a life of meaning and fulfill the needs of others, the more you tend to be happy. So it starts from that selfish point of view, and then it leads to the way to actually achieve your selfish ends is to be a compassionate person. But you're not quite compassionate yet because it's still got that selfish root. It's like a long-standing debate within Western psychology and philosophy is, can anyone truly be compassionate? If it makes you happy to be compassionate, then it's not really compassion, is it? Well, then Buddhism says at a certain point, if you practice meditation and self-examination, you unravel this knot of the illusion of self. And once that unraveling occurs, other people's pain and pleasure affects you in this kind of enlightened way, which is different from being selfishly motivated. So suddenly all the pleasure and pain of all sentient beings become a part of your pleasure and pain. And that's a fundamentally different, qualitatively different level of compassionate action than being motivated just to live a life that will lead to less pain for you. So I think that that's, again, a part of this question of if you're really interested in the project of creating friendly artificial intelligence, which tries to, in a wise way and not in some crude way or an enslaved way, create the greatest good for the greatest number, then what is the developmental process that is required to get there? And Buddhism at least suggests that it requires going through that selfish phase and teaching a robot to overcome its own dukkha and eventually get to an enlightened understanding of compassion. And hopefully robots will get there faster than human beings do, because it takes human beings lifetime after lifetime, apparently.
Well, you've mentioned virtue ethics a couple of times. Can you just lay out the fundamentals of that ethical system?
So in Western ethical thought, we think about different flavors of ethics, three different basic flavors. One is deontology, which basically there's certain things that are right and wrong, and it doesn't make any difference what the consequences are. You should never do wrong things and always do right things. Virtue ethics says that the focus should be on motivation and the character of the person who's doing things, what's right and wrong may differ from situation to situation. It may be right in some circumstances to lie, steal, or kill, and it depends on the motivation with which you do that, and you need a mature, wise, moral character in order to do the right thing. And that tends to be the Aristotelian approach. And then the utilitarian, or the more modern approach, is that the consequences are what's important, that if you know you're going to save five lives instead of one, then you should be able to kill the one to save the five. And Buddhism, as I said, its ultimate goal is to create a creature, a person, a bodhisattva, who is motivated by the pleasures and needs of all sentient beings. And so that is a kind of utilitarian goal, some enlightened version of utilitarianism. It's not obviously the crude version that everyone should have heroin and meth, but some kind of enlightened service of all human, of all sentient beings. But the way to get there is through the cultivation of character and virtue. And so it Buddhism combines, and then the starting point is deontology, which is that the lay people are taught that there are certain ineluctable consequences of moral actions. You do X and you're going to have bad karma, and you do Y, you're going to have good karma. So it starts with deontology, it evolves towards virtue and character development, and eventually it ends up at a utilitarian ethics.
And bodhisattvas, as I understand it, are, well, at least in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, they are beings that kind of postpone their own enlightenment for the sake of helping all suffering beings. So there is a strong kind of utilitarian element to what they're doing, greatest happiness of the greatest number, perhaps, although with the wrinkles that you've laid out. You point in your essay, and again, we're speaking with James Hughes about a article he wrote about compassionate artificial intelligence and what a Buddhist framework might lend to that project, the creation of compassionate AI. You write that the Buddhist tradition specifies six fundamental virtues or perfections, paramitas, to cultivate in the path to transcending the illusion of self. They are generosity, moral conduct, patience, diligence, one-pointed concentration, and wisdom insight. Now, there's a lot to talk about here, but is it correct to conclude, at least based on what you've already said, that if these virtues are somehow to be assigned to or inculcated in a machine mind, that it's best if kind of a developmental approach is used, that a sense that the AI mind will develop these through a process of growth and evolution and development?
Exactly. And I think one of the ways in which religious virtue ethics traditions will inform both human moral psychology and the emerging robot ethics debate is that for instance, I'll give an example that in human bioethics, where there's a debate around moral enhancement. What's the best way to enhance the moral behavior of human beings? And some have argued that we should jack up things like oxytocin in the human brain because oxytocin tends to, among its many effects, make people somewhat more empathetic to other people's pain and might improve their moral behavior. And others say, no, what's important is to improve their cognition because if they could see their own biases and understand situations better, they could come to better moral conclusions. Well, every virtue ethics tradition, as an example here, Buddhism and its theory of paramitas, argues for a multiplicity of virtues which have to be cultivated together and which balance one another. And Aristotle and the Buddha both made the point that any one virtue taken to its extreme becomes a vice. You know, if you are compassionate to an extreme and you give away all your clothes and your wife and your kids, as the Buddha did in one of his previous incarnations, that can turn out to be a vice. And if you're patient to an extreme and never act, that can turn out to be a vice. And so all of these things have to be held in balance and cultivated together. I think that's one of the very important points that can contribute to an understanding of the complexity of building a moral character in a machine.
How might the virtue of patience be inculcated into an artificially intelligent mind?
Well, so patience is a part of a constellation of virtues that we understand as self-control now. And self-control is kind of the base, the most fundamental of all the virtues. If you don't have self-control, it's almost impossible to cultivate the others. But it's your own capacity to, first, to see what your own long-term interests are, and to say, I can defer the eating of this one marshmallow if I can have two marshmallows later. And then later to defer the gratification of your own desires if you have larger goals. If your goal is the service of others, then to have the patience to not gratify yourself and to serve those others is an important virtue in and of itself. The self-control in general, I think, is another way in which emerging moral neuroscience would contribute to the robotic understanding.
Well, one thing I'm really taking away from this inquiry, this look at how Buddhist thought might affect or could affect the creation of machine minds, is that this is an incredibly complex endeavor, the programming of artificially intelligent beings. I mean, are we at a point really where it's almost impossible to imagine that artificially intelligent minds could be programmed in a way that could match the nuance and complexity required, that could exhibit a kind of moral and ethical behavior that approximates how human ethical behavior manifests?
I think the field of artificial intelligence is plagued both at the certainly at the lay level, but even at the expert level, by a great deal of anthropomorphism. Another way of saying that is that the space of all possible minds is probably so enormous that we can't even understand how big it is. And because the only kinds of minds that we see around us are minds that diverged from ours about 70 million years ago at most, most of the mammals. And so, you know, it's a very limited space of minds that we have access to. And the ones that we're relatively close to, like chimpanzees and dolphins, we still have a heck of a time communicating with those and understanding their motivations and the complexity of the way that their brains are structured. And we're only, you know, shortly diverged from them. So you imagine creating a machine mind de novo without necessarily any of the architecture of a mammal brain. It could have sensations without self. It could have self without, you know, without body. This is part of the question that the essay is trying to pose. But many of us want eventually to have these super intelligent minds that have some of the capabilities of a human mind, but can do more than we can do, and have the wisdom to be able to control themselves and to be a part of a functioning part of our human civilization. And so one of the debates in artificial intelligence is whether you create that kind of a mind de novo by trying to put together what we understand about brains, or whether you scan a brain and try to emulate, you know, an actual copy of a human brain. I don't have a strong opinion about one or the other. I think both avenues of research are going to happen. But clearly, if we're trying to create a human brain and then a human brain plus as the project of artificial general intelligence, it's a very narrow target that we're aiming for. And we have to understand that target really well. Otherwise, we're going to be out in, you know, Alpha Centauri instead of anywhere close to the solar system.
James Hughes, bioethicist, sociologist at Trinity College in Connecticut, directs the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, author of Citizen Cyborg, and we've been talking about an essay he wrote for the volume Robot Ethics, The Ethical and Social Implications of Robotics. James, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
And we had production assistance today from Kimberly Schreiber. This is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.